Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
White people got more in common with colored people than they do with rich people. We just got to eliminate them.
Eliminate?
Eliminate.
Who, rich people?
White people. Damn. Black people, too. Brown people, yellow people. Get rid of them all. All we need is a voluntary, free-spirited, open-ended program of procreative racial deconstruction. Everybody just got to keep fucking everybody till they're all the same color?
Damn.
I think it...
In my prime... I had a thing for nigger juice myself. I ain't just like his daddy. He ain't a man till he split dark oak.
I got something to say. And then I ain't gonna say no more. He took advantage of me. And if you fine, fancy gentlemen ain't gonna do nothing about it, then you're just a bunch of lousy, yellow, stinking cowards. The whole bunch of you. And your fancy ass don't come to nothing. Your mammon and your Miss May Ellen, it don't come to nothing, Mr. Fish.
Down there. Brown University's Board of Education.
Dennis Johnson was defending his doctoral dissertation last week.
Students of color were not achieving at the same rate as
when this happened.
I see a circle on my screen, and then I see another circle, and then another shape, and it's like it's a penis. And then I see the letters N-I-G-G-E-R.
We blurred the content, but Johnson's faculty saw the full effect of what's known as Zoom bombing. Malicious users invade a chat group, often with profanity and racial slurs. It's happening in Canada, too.
They started shouting racial epithets. They shouted the N-word.
Maya Roy says a 250-person town hall she hosted earlier this week for the YWCA was attacked.
It's not just a couple of kids messing around with your Zoom call or with your Zoom meeting. They are using hate speech.
The FBI told CBC News it's investigating a handful of what it calls video teleconferencing hijacking.
Also in pornography, the sexual trauma and sexual terrorism that has been experienced by black women has been erased. For example, in the 1985 porn video, Let Me Tell You About Black Chicks, two men are dressed as members of Ku Klux Klan, a white supremacist organization. And when the pair encounters Sahara, a maid, they begin a series of racial remarks that continues throughout the scene.
Oh, shit, listen, let's fuck the shit out of this darkie.
And despite the insults, or perhaps because of these insults,
great-grandpappy used to say that in the old days, that this shit was fine.
Sahara the maid becomes this enthusiastic participant in this sexual encounter, which includes oral sex, double penetrations, and then she goes back later in time, and she relates this sexual experience to the other maids, and she describes it as an experience that is just too good.
It's bad enough to let two whites do your pussy, but two Klansmen, girl, you're evil.
Now, if you knew how good it was, you'd be out there looking for you a couple of honkies, too.
More recently, there's another porn series that shows black women enjoying sexual relationships with men who are waving Confederate flags, and porn describes this as hillbilly hog heaven. Now, these men aren't dressed in Ku Klux Klan hoods anymore, but they're covered in Confederate flags.
The Cows, Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, November 17, 2020. So I have been told. Check out the archives. If we make it past the Rona and we get to February 2021, it'll be a dozen years that we will have been broadcasting. I am amazed myself. I don't say that we've done 12 years of outstanding work, because that might not be true, but we have for 12 years talked about the system of white supremacy racism. When I was listening to the introduction for today's broadcast, that was Dr. Carolyn West at the end in her documentary film, Let Me Tell Y'all About Black Chicks. I totally forgot. Oh, yeah, she was on the program. 2018, we did all that talking about racism in pornography and what does that say about the system of white supremacy and so many of the contradictions. If you take a gander at some of the popular pornography, Dr. Carolyn West, in the archives, definitely her subject matter is something to keep in mind for our topic for today. Let's see. Let me see if I can make sure I get all of the intro clips. So we got some of our favorites. We heard the segment from Bullworth, Just Need to Have More Sex to Get Rid of White People and Black People. Yes, yes. Halle Berry was in that one. One of the greatest films and books of all time. Harper Lee's classic To Kill a Mockingbird, one of the greatest court scene films in the history of film. Miss Ella May's commentary, that old Tom Robbins raped me, and you all better do something about it, which they did. Poor Tom Robbins. We heard Monsters Ball. Halle Berry again. I didn't even do that consciously. Woof. Halle Berry again. Monsters Ball, infamous film, and the scene where she speaks to Tommy Lee Jones' character's father, and he talks about his hankering for dark oak, which strangely sounds a little bit like what Dr. Carolyn West was talking about, but she was in a documentary. And then in the middle of all of that, we had the segment from CBC News where they talked about the global problem. I could have switched that one out and played the segment from Austria this weekend. We had on our Global Sunday Talk on Racism, African 1884 said, even in Austria, the Zoom conferences interrupted strangers hopping in the room and writing nigra and putting penises. All, haven't I said, that's all year long. Anywho, all of that should make sense in the context of our dialogue for today. Brand new book just published this year in the midst of all of the chaos. I saw it and said, oh my goodness, this is one of our favorite areas of subject matter. Remember Danielle McGuire was on the program at the dark end of the street? That's on my library behind me. Like, man, this is one that we've talked about for years and years and years. Renethia Tate and Pam, the interracial con gang. Lots of listeners should have questions and interest. If you're looking for new material to read, here you go. The book that caught my attention, White Fright, The Sexual Panic at the Heart of America's Racist History. And it goes from there. That's everything that you heard in the introduction. Whammo, we'll see how it relates. And in fact, I'll give you two of my favorite sentences in the whole book. Before we get started, sentence number one, and I kid you, I'm going to read it exactly the way it's written, and you'll know, anyone who's listened to The Cows, you'll know immediately why this is one of my favorite sentences. So I'm reading it exactly. I'm not changing a word. This is exactly how it's written. This means Frederick Reed, who lived with his wife at the Mayflower Hotel, exactly as it's written, that a nigra can walk into the restaurant at the Mayflower and sit down and eat at the table right next to Mrs. Reed. That's one, exactly as it's written. And then the second one, second favorite line in the book. Let's see. Oh, and it's right a few pages down, too. It's not even that far away. Let's see. Oh, I lost my place mark. I'll have to get it as we go. I know I have that one highlighted as well. It's one of the... Oh, there we go. I found it. It was a few sentences down. Here we go. Get that one. This is my second favorite. Making the traditional link between the vote, education, and sexual rights, Milam continued, niggers ain't gonna vote where I live. They ain't gonna go to school with my kids. And when a nigger gets close to mentioning sex with a white woman, he's tired of living. And even, I didn't even read that one exactly right. He's tired of living. That's it. Not of. Tired of living. Wow. We are known for saying white people can show you better than I can tell you. Two great quotes. Our guest for today's program, she is the author of White Fright, which explores all of this with sex and racism. Her research revolves around the relationship between race, sex, and politics in post-emancipation South. Pleasure to have her on the program joining us live, Dr. Jane Daly. Dr. Daly, are you with us?
I am, and Gus, congratulations on your almost anniversary.
We'll see if we get to February. It has been, wow, we'll see if we get there.
Yeah.
For folks, I'm sure we have some people who this will be their first time hearing about you and the work that you do. An associate professor of history at the University of Chicago. For listeners who this is their first time hearing about you, could you give kind of a quick intro, just more about the work that you do?
Oh, thanks. Sure. So I wrote a dissertation and then a first book that was looking at successful instances of interracial democracy in the post-Reconstruction South. And so I focused on Virginia, which had a third-party interracial government in the 1880s that, you know, elected United States senators and congressmen and elected a lot of African-American office holders to things like school boards, for example, and as police officers. And that didn't go down very well with a lot of white Virginians. So in the end, they're, you know, like most experiments in interracial democracy in the South, they're blown up through a combination of election fraud and violence. But that got me thinking about what people had to say about sex in schools. Because when I was researching for that book, looking at the 1880s, and people were saying things just like you quoted, you know, saying, wow, you know, if we let, you know, black children in our schools, they're going to marry our daughters. And that sounded very similar to me to what people said after Brown versus Board of Education. And so I kind of leapt forward a century and went from there.
Fascinating. We will get into more of the details in White Fright. For listeners who have not seen you before, you are a white woman. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Right on.
As far as I know.
Right on. Your last name and you being in the Illinois area, I said, are you affiliated with the Chicago Daily political machine at all?
No, I'm not. It's spelled differently. When I first moved here, I thought if I said my name, you know, Daly as in the mayor, that I might get like a good table in a restaurant, till I realized that just everybody hated him and that wasn't helping my cause at all.
All righty. Just checking. This program, we use the term racism, the term white supremacy as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Yeah, I think that's a great definition. It's very hard to come up with a good working definition of racism in particular. White supremacy is not quite as hard. But yes, I do think that system exists. And the people who believe that certainly exist.
Let's see. Well, one, I have concluded that frequently One of the primary methods that white people use to maintain the system of white supremacy is deception. They will not use accurate terms. They will obfuscate, pussyfoot, especially when talking to non-white people and especially about racism. Very difficult time being honest, truthful. Sometimes they won't answer questions directly. So if you could make every effort, be accurate, honest in speaking with us, answering questions, and trying to, we're going to try to cover as much material as possible. So hopefully we won't have, you can be direct. You can give us, you know, nuance to answer your question, but be direct. Make sure you're answering questions and being truthful. Is that something you can do with us this evening, Dr. Daly?
I sure think so.
Awesome. I've enjoyed asking our white guests this question for a number of years now. There's a non-white author, and he wrote a piece, and he was talking about racism, and he said, white people are often greatly and sincerely pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough. I've been asking our white guests the first portion of that sentence, just based on your studies. You are a white person, the white people that you've been around, friends, family, and the like. Do you think the first portion of that sentence is accurate? That white people, like a substantial number of white people, are often greatly and sincerely pained by racism?
Well, I'm not sure what I would do with often in that sentence, but on the whole, I think that that is true, and that's true for the people I meet in the past, like in the book, the kind of white moderates in the South who you know, feel pained, but as your source goes on to say, don't do anything about it, and don't feel that pain deeply enough.
Okay, now this is one of those where I'd say being honest, no pussyfooting, because often is in the statement. So that's what I'm saying, like the statement is, white people are often greatly.
I think that's optimistic, actually.
Okay, so the question is that a true statement that white people, like a substantial number of them, are often greatly and sincerely pained by racism?
Yeah, no, your inflections are convincing me that is too optimistic. I think that people aren't necessarily often. Sincerely is hard to gauge, and greatly, again, hard to say.
Much of it is hard to say, in my opinion. I guess it would come down to what the cliche they use, the proof is in the pudding. If a substantial number of white people were often, and this sentence was made years ago, so...
Yeah,
often,
it sounds like it.
Sincerely and greatly pained. Wow, we should have some evidence of their, you know, concern about this, I would think. But
yeah.
I've been asking our white guests that one for a while. The responses have been fascinating. Let's see, specifically with your book that just came out this year, Current Literature.
Just today.
Wowee. How about that?
It's book day, man.
Book day. White fright. Reading is more important than watching television. What problem were you trying to solve, if any, with the book White Fright?
I think the problem I tried to solve, you know, I've read a lot of civil rights history. I've written some civil rights history. I was coming from the 19th century into the 20th century. And what I knew from the 19th century was that African-American leaders like Frederick Douglass spoke very openly and clearly about their desire for what they called full equality, meaning, you know, just simply whatever rights anybody else had, African-Americans wanted too. And that included marriage equality. That kind of surprised me when I first read that in the 19th century. And they thought, you know, free people marry whoever they want to marry, and they don't need the state to tell them, you know, who they can marry and who they can't marry. And so I wonder, well, why was that not a theme in our understanding of the civil rights movement? You know, why didn't we really talk about you know, marriage rights and people's desire for the possibility of marrying across the color line. And so I went into it asking that question, like, why has that not been part of the mainstream civil rights narrative?
Okay. And is there an answer? Did you answer your question? Why has this not been a part of the mainstream civil rights narrative?
Mostly it is because the people who are strategizing the civil rights movement, even though, and here was the paradox, they were deeply committed to full equality, meaning everything. But they also had a very hard time getting around this problem that if they said that black people wanted anything, you know, decent schools, the right to vote, that white supremacists would say, well, that means they want to marry your sister. And as crazy as it sounds to us today, that was a very powerful statement in the South before World War II. It loses a lot of its potency afterwards. But before World War II, it was really hard to just try and not have that be part of the conversation, so that people who were working for black equality didn't put that at the top of the list.
Hmm. Fascinating. For our listeners, just before we start to get into some of the different portions of the text, in your response right there, you were saying, as crazy as it might sound today, hearing someone say that they just want civil rights, equality, that somehow is equated with, oh, you want to sleep with my daughter, you want to marry our daughter, and all of that. Mm-hmm. That does not sound crazy to me today, and I would hope not mm-hmm. crazy to uh-huh. Cal's listeners. For one, there was Governor LePage up in New England who said that Smoothie D and these folks are coming up here to sell drugs and get our white girls pregnant. And he said white specifically. It wasn't a concern mm-hmm. about all of the girls. And that's not ancient history.
Yep.
And
no, it's not.
We had Jacqueline Battalora as a guest on the program twice. The first time around, she said she's a professor in Illinois, no less, Xavier University, mm-hmm. white woman. She said she's done an experiment. She will tell her white students, white female students, she will tell them to go home and tell their parents that they are dating a black guy and see what happens. Now, this is also recent, not 1930s, 1960s, 1990s, real recent. OJ's mm-hmm. out of prison recent. And she said the response is like, what? What are you doing? Negroes. So, no. And
wow.
my last one, I just go to the census always because you include that. The rates, I think it's 17% so-called interracial marriages. We've talked about that. When you tease
right.
that out, because you include in parentheses so-called Asians and Latinos, very few white people marry black people. When you tease out white and black marriages,
mm-hmm.
it's not 17%. It's something like way low, like less than 5%.
Yeah.
Like, that is not crazy at all. White people saying no nigra is going to marry my daughter.
No, no.
That's not crazy even going into 2021, right?
Right. No, unfortunately, I think you're right about that. So if you look, if you want to find interracial marriages in general and white-black marriages in particular, the best place to look for them is the Army.
And,
are you still there?
Oh, yes. I'm trying to even make sense of that.
Since the Army aid desegregated in 1948 and then started having, you know, many, many more women, there are a lot of, you know, minorities of all possibilities in the armed forces and whites, and they work together and they live in a society, you know, an enforced society of equality. And apparently, that is a good breeding ground. I don't want to say that, but those are good circumstances for people to get to know each other, without some of the, you know, prejudices and bigotry of their parents hanging over them.
Hmm. I don't know. We've heard a lot of, I'll pause for Lavina Johnson. I'll leave it at that. Pause for
okay.
Lavina Johnson. Getting to the book White Fright, I pay attention to terms. Words are very important, and part of that goes back to at the beginning what I stated. One of the primary methods in terms of white people practicing racism, white supremacy, is deception. One component of that is they will do a lot of deliberate pussyfooting, not using correct words to describe a problem. And one of the terms that I pay attention to when people talk about white supremacy, racism, they'll use the term race relations. James Lowen uses that term a lot in his book, Sundown Towns, which is even more remarkable. I'll give an example for context. You say scores of race riots. This is talking about black veterans coming back and this how this had a huge impact on the so-called quest for civil rights. You write scores of race riots, including in Chicago and St. Louis, left untold numbers dead, wounded, and homeless, and the victims were not all black. African-American soldiers returned home ready to fire back. Indeed, observers at the time considered black self-defense a watershed in a American race relations. What do you mean with the term race relations?
Oh, good question. That's an instance of my using the terms that the people I'm talking about were talking about. So if you'd used that term in 1920, what you meant was people who worked in usually interracial organizations that were supportive of black equality and black rights.
That's what that means, black equality and black rights. I would have to go and take that and look to see if that makes sense to the, because it's in here quite a few times. I would even say to the initial portion of your response, if we're talking about the system of white supremacy racism, which you and I agree exists, and even my definition specifically, if that's what we're talking about, which this book definitely is, that's what, you know, we should be using terms that reflect that we're talking about a power relationship, white people having power to dominate and terrorize non-white people, black people specifically. Race relations makes it seem like it's a bit more equitable than it is, almost like it's a Hatfield and McCoy's bickering type thing, and that's not what this is at all. And I would just add, if it's just using terms that are used in the parlance of those times, you don't say nigra in the book, and that was certainly used commonly in the parlance of those times. I think the general procedure would be to use quotation marks. You don't have race relations in quotation marks, and you use it repeatedly.
No, it's a fair cop. I could just as easily have said that the militants of returning black soldiers gave white supremacists pause.
Clarity is important. I'll leave race relations pops because it's in here quite a few times. It's in James Lowen's book 100 times. And I'm saying this is not, me trying to be cute. It's superly important. James Lowen, he's talking about sundown towns. Now, they got billboards, not postcards, billboards that say, Nigra, if you can read, run.
You're right.
And the like. Yeah. And this is a widespread thing. That's not race relations.
That's not
that
race
is white
relations.
Power
no,
and tell, like, what are we even talking about? Like, I emailed him and told him that. And this is not a one-time thing. This is very common in finding different tacky words, marginalization, that get away from what are we talking about? White terrorism and white supremacy. Call things by their proper names. This is a separate page you write in several articles written for a popular audience after World War I. Boas questioned the methodology of the intelligence tests conducted by the U.S. Army, which had seemingly demonstrated the mental inferiority of African Americans, and applied his conclusions to American race relations. It's not in quotes there either. That's what I mean. Calling things by their proper name is appropriate. Anywho, let's see. At a different point in the text, this is on page 40, you write, the point of segregation was to keep non-white people in the in their separate and inferior places. To do that, the state had to be able to tell who was who. Can you expand a little bit about this and how this relates to the so-called anti-miscegenation laws?
Sure. I mean, it goes to the question of what is race, in part. You know, are we operating in a kind of essentialistic idea where people are black or white or not black or not white? If you've got a state that is built on a really fictional idea of racial hierarchy and superiority, as I say in the book, you have to know where to put people. And the problem with interracial sex, whether in marriage or not in marriage, for that system, is that it mixes things up. So you have to, you know, write all of these laws that say these people can't marry these people and those people can't marry those people. And, you know, without those laws, race as a legal thing collapses.
Racial classifications are hugely important in our almost 12 years. Ian Hani Lopez, we had him as a guest on the program. We discussed mm-hmm. his book, White by Law, which hugely important, talks about this sort of thing.
Yes.
Exactly. In those racial, that's why I ask all of our guests, number one question, let's get the racial classification straight. That is important. I do say, I guess number one, with the separation, because that's another one, I think it's important to be accurate. There's been a lot of sexual intercourse going on, white people with these marriage mm-hmm. laws and what. That's why I play that clip with Dr. Carolyn West. So important, the hypocrisy.
Yeah.
It's not that we're mm-hmm. trying to prohibit white people from having white males or white females,
right.
being truthful, from having sexual access to black people. That has never been the case, correct, Dr. Daly?
Yes, and you know, I'm sure you know the famous James Baldwin quote about this, which is just absolutely brilliant. James Baldwin is being pressed on this issue, and he looks to the white man who's on stage with him, and he says, you know what? He says, you're not worried that I'm going to marry your daughter. You're worried I'm going to marry your wife's daughter. Meaning that white man next to him probably also had all kinds of daughters who were categorized differently.
Very important to kind of keep that in the forefront, the hypocrisy, flagrant hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
I always
mm-hmm.
point to Strom Thurmond, that the same people that are running around and stay away from the Negro, stay away from the Negro,
yep.
and what in the world? Like, so it's not exact. That's why I say terms, because of the way it's written, it's Jim Crow had been built on the foundation of anti-miscegenation laws in the late 19th
mm-hmm.
century. Oops, wrong quote. The point of segregation was to keep non-white people in their separate, and I always say that is not accurate. This is not about separation. Strom Thurmond would not be raping some teenage black female if this was about separation. Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, I mean, you can pick, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Carolyn West's research would not exist if this was about separation. That's not what. That's why I go back to the term. It's white supremacy racism. It's not race relations. It's not separation. This is about white terrorism, domination, and white power over non-white people. Is that accurate, Dr. Daly?
It's accurate. I think it's maybe one-sided. I'm not sure that it gets into the lived experience of people in the past. All that much. What I was trying to do there, I think, was to describe a system of laws that, you know, the separate and unequal is obviously a play off of Plessy versus Ferguson's language of, you know, and the 14th Amendment. So that's where the language in that particular sentence comes from. But yes, there is a lot of sexual terrorism in the South. There's terrorism in general in a system that is premised on equality. Inequality, and highly uneven power relations.
When you started your response, when you said that it, what I said was one-sided, can you elaborate?
Here's we say how direct we get. So you know what, Annette Gordon-Reed wrote that wonderful book, right, The Hemingses of Monticello. And she was criticized very strongly for suggesting that Sally Hemings had feelings for Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, there was a long debate over whether or not love can cross such a chasm of power. And we, you know, we're not going to be able to actually come to a conclusion in that debate, but I think she was right to point out, you know, the extent of their relationship and to use that she had, the evidence she had at hand from Sally Hemings' brother, Peter, and other people to try and get at the texture of that relationship in a three-dimensional way.
Fascinating. Fascinating. We have not, I have that book on my bookshelf right here.
Oh.
I have not read it yet. I said we need to make that a project. It is so important because we talk, or I have talked about that debate, and we've had guests on who've talked about it. Henry Wancek, who is a white man, who talked about, went into detail, and he took the opposing view, which is Annette Gordon-Reed is a black female victim of racism who articulates this kind of so-called love between Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. And Henry Wancek is a white man. He wrote Masters of the Mountain, which is also a biography on Thomas Jefferson. And he took the opposite view that that is not possible, just following logic. She's a slave. Incidentally, is the age differential important to you in all of this, in terms of Thomas Jefferson being mid-30s, Sally Hemings being a teenager? Is that, does that factor into this arrangement?
Sure. Although, again, in the 18th century, it was not unheard of for a widower in his 30s to marry, you know, a young sort of Princess Diana age girl, right? 17, 18. Sally Hemings was younger than that.
Say that last part again, please.
I said Sally Hemings was younger than that. She was, what, 16, 14, 16 when she came back from Paris, I think. So, yes, obviously. But, again, if you're looking at the 18th century, the power relationships between men and women are highly skewed, so that even a married woman is in a relationship where her husband has most of the power. So I think we have to, you know, not necessarily look at things exclusively from our 21st century vantage point.
Well, I try to be accurate, and even your sentence just there between a man and a woman, you certainly 18th century, even 21st century would have to mean skewed between the laughter. There's a reason I say for our Cal's guests again, the laughter just right there is why we only have white guests on the program now. It maybe should have been that from the beginning at 12 years, but either way, the laughter, you would have to be talking about white men and white women, because black males in the 18th century certainly did not have a power differential over white females, black females, children, porcupines. Am I incorrect, Dr. Daly?
Yes.
Let's point it out. Hear it. Let's explain.
I think that in the 18th century, there were lots of free black men in the United States. So let's put slavery to the side, because that makes things difficult if you're talking about this particular relationship of black men in a position of power over others, rather than, you know, always being in a, you know, under other people's thumbs. I would say that, you know, a black man who has, you know, legally married to a black woman in the state of New York, or a white woman for that matter in the state of New York, because it was legal, has all of the power that his status as a husband gives him under the law. And that's the same for as a father. If you have legal children in, you know, any of the colonies that are not slave colonies, or as free people in, say, Baltimore, a city in a slave state that still had a big free population. So I think, again, I think that, you know, your black men who were fathers and legal fathers and husbands in that era would have said, you know, hell yes, I've got some power.
We did read Solomon Northup. I think that was one of a free black male, and hear about how much power he exercised, 12 years a slave. I could be.
No, of course not. He was kidnapped. That was, I mean, that was, no, this is not to say that you know, Solomon's Northup's life was not made hell, and that the lives of free black people were not constantly insecure, even in the North, where slave catchers came and kidnapped them like Northup and took them back south. You know, but it's a big world there.
It's a big, I didn't hear the last part. Can you repeat that, please?
I just said it's a big world in the 18th century in this period.
Okay. Listeners can feel free. Make sure I give out the number. You can let me know if Gus T is being one-sided or, you know, leaving out aspects of black male power in 18th century or now 21st century, either or. The number is 720-716-7300. The code is 564-943. Pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We'll nab some of the folks.
Gus, can I?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
What's COW?
The acronym for the program?
COW.
Context of White Supremacy. It's an acronym. Context of White Supremacy. COWs. COWs.
Got it.
Yes, ma'am. Let's see. Before I nab some of our callers, you write about one black male, W.E.B. Du Bois, and lots of the folks. This is kind of early 20th century and the impact of the war. I already read the portion in the book where you talk about how the returning black veterans, the huge impact that they had coming back and being uppity, and maybe they've had access to white women overseas, and oh my gosh, now they're not going to come back and, you know, be well behaved in our dynamics of race relations. And you write about how when we're going into World War II, particularly in the black press, pause right there, the importance of black journalists. You do quote, Dr. Daly does quote a lot of clippings from the black press throughout this period. We try to emphasize that on this program a lot, the importance of black journalists well represented in the text. Anywho, you talk about how going into World War II, many outlets, the black press, compared the white supremacy racism here in the States to what was happening in Nazi Germany. Not everybody, not a monolith, not everyone took that position. You write in a 1937 article titled "Hitler Far Ahead of Simon Legree," W.E.B. Du Bois agreed with Odom. The attacks on Jews in Germany, Du Bois reported, were more vicious than anything ever experienced in America. The treatment of the Negro here cannot be compared to the German situation. As he elaborated after a trip there, there is a campaign of race prejudice carried on in Germany openly, continuously, and determinedly against all non-Nordic races, but specifically against the Jews, which surpasses in vindictive cruelty and public insult anything I have ever seen, and I have seen much. What do you make of Du Bois' statement here?
He's doing a couple of things there. I think In a kind of sidebar political conversation, he's talking to communists in the United States who are downplaying what's happening in Europe. And so I think he's saying to them, we don't, it's an interesting quote because you don't say, you know, there's number one and number two here. But he is also speaking to white Americans who are not paying attention to what's happening in Germany. The New York Times was not reporting on this the way the black press was. If you were black in America, you had a much better idea of what was happening in the 1930s in Germany than if you were white, unless you read the black newspapers, which some people did, but most people didn't. And so he's also speaking there to white Americans, saying, you know, anybody who's telling you that what the Nazis are doing is just like what we do here, you know, with a little segregation, park bench thing. There's more to it than that.
I was just thinking about what you were mentioning about reading the press clippings. You would have substantially lower literacy rates 80 years ago. So that would certainly impact in a different way than we might think who might be able to read the black press or any press clippings. Is that accurate, well, Dr. Daly?
Yes and no. You know, I'd have to, I don't know the literacy rate for white and black Americans in 1940. The literacy rate for African Americans in the post-emancipation era, so between 1865 and 1900, just skyrockets. That was one of the things the freed people wanted most of all, was to know to read and to be literate. And, to, you know, they understood, obviously, the importance of that, and it's something that scared white Southerners to death because there was a reason that they made it illegal to teach a slave to read. They knew that it was power. So the literacy rates between white and black Southerners, Americans, in 1940 might not be as far apart as they seem, and especially not in the South, where you have a lot of illiterate white people as well as illiterate black people.
You would still have Ben Tillman. We did read his autobiography talking about white people who were opposed to black people getting education.
Yes.
Governor in South Carolina, former United States Senator in South Carolina, a candidate for president. And even after all of this, Dylan Storm Roof and everything, still has his statues in South, statues plural, in South Carolina. System of white supremacy.
Yes.
I was going to get our callers, but I'll get in one more tidbit from the text. You, in a deliberately circuitous route, get to Emmett Till's lynching, which certainly would revolve a lot about revolve around white fright and control of black sexuality. But you get to that through his father and his experience talking about black veterans and their experience. Can you just give a bit of the detail to that and the kind of significance of this Rings transition?
Yeah. Emmett Till's father was named Lewis Till. He was a very colorful person. He was big. He was smart. He was a boxer. He was a gambler in Chicago. And he and Emmett's mother split up pretty early. But the father, and we knew this first because when Emmett Till was lynched, the Mississippi senators put out something saying, well, his father, Lewis, was a rapist, like father, like son. And they pointed to the facts, and it's true, that Lewis Till was executed by the American Army in Italy in 1945 on charges of murder and rape. So when I found that story, I wanted to know what the story was there, and it was hard because the records were basically sealed in the National Archives. But I found Lewis Till, the story of Lewis Till, I think basically being framed, and then what happened to his son was so poignant that I just wanted the intergenerational aspect.
And after you said it was kind of difficult to get information, did you have to go like through Army archives to kind of find out what happened in some of the court proceedings, or how did you kind of go about digging to get some of this information?
I finally got the court martial file, which shouldn't have been impossible to get, but took a lot of wrangling. I mean, the thing about the Southern senators, you know, nobody should have had that court-martial report in 1945 except for the Army, but they obviously gave it to the Southern senators in 1955 during the Emmett Till controversy so that they can have this ammunition.
Wow. You said it seemed like it was more difficult to obtain than it needed to be. Do you think it may have been white supremacy racism in terms of someone's did not want this information accessible to the public?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there are every professor tells their graduate students, make friends with the archivist, because the archivist knows what's in the courthouse. The archivist knows what's in the library, what's in the collection, and, you know, more than anybody else does. And archivists can, you know, make things difficult for you to find. They can make things easy for you to find. They can bring things to your attention. So that's part of, you know, part of digging up the past.
Metaphor. I will point out, since we mentioned James Loewen, the deliberateness in terms of white people practicing racism, white supremacy, this is widespread. And he talked about when you go through, sometimes it's difficult to even find how many of the purges of black towns that there have been and these type of events, because you go to look in the records and they've been purged. He said you'll go to look for a newspaper record from a certain date, sometime like 1937 or 1919. And where is it at? What's going on? And, oh, we had, you know, a rat problem or fire. We suspiciously fire. At the exact dates when something happened in the town. You were going to comment, Dr. Daly?
Yeah, no, I'm sure everybody, we've come across that. You know, 25 years ago, it was not unusual to go to the South, and they didn't really want to show you their archives about slavery, because nobody looked at those archives in the 40s and the 50s. Why did all these mostly Yankees, you know, coming down, want to look at this ugly stuff? Why can't they write about something nice? So, yes, things disappear. And absolutely, I'm sure that the basis for that was trying to kill the story.
Trying to conceal white supremacy, racism, and James Loewen, there were more of these sundown towns in the North than the South. This deliberate act of concealment, widespread in the system of white supremacy. Let's see, I'll nab a few of the callers as we proceed. Let's see, our caller at a blocked number, did you have a question for Dr. Jane Daly? You should be with us.
Yes, hi, Gus.
Be in Toronto, yes, ma'am.
Hi, greetings to you callers and listeners, and greetings to your guest, Dr. Jane Daly. Dr. Daly, you consider yourself a historian?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So I have three quick questions for you. The first one being, the white feminist Frances Willard in 1885 pressed for rape charges against men, in particular white men, by increasing the age of consent, because white men in particular were sexually molesting and raping children ages 10 and under, often justifying their action of child rape based on race and social class of the child. So going to 1967, or even just prior to then, that's dealing with the Loving versus Virginia. Mildred was age 11 when Richard Loving, age 17, began grooming her into being child raped. So how is it that in 1885 there is the press for rape charges against white men who are raping, engaging in child rape, but then the Richard Loving case where he was raping Mildred since she was 11 is considered a fundamental freedom in interracial marriage? I mean, how is it that in 1967 pedophilia is paraded as some kind of epitome of fundamental freedom in African American civil rights? So that's the first question. And then the second question I have for you is, I don't really think any of this is funny. I think it's rather tragic. I mean, pedophilia is not a funny issue, along with racism and racism. So how have whites been frightened by black sexuality when whites have utilized and weaponized sex as an oppressive tool to exploit, shame, and subjugate the enslaved and descendants of the enslaved for wealth and dominance through buck-breaking, child molestation, rape and impregnating teens and adults, and forced sexual encounters between same-sex genders in slavery and in current mass incarcerations against black people? So those are the two main ones. Thank you, and I leave the line.
Okay. Thank you. I don't want to leave a misunderstanding. I wasn't meaning to giggle at the idea of pedophilia. I was chuckling and thought, oh, no, that was one big question, and you were already going into another big question. The question about the Lovings is very interesting. I also have been observed the age difference between them. I have never, you know, the Lovings have been written on quite a bit, which is why I don't write on them very much. Never in the things that I've read about the Lovings has it been suggested that Richard raped Mildred. I don't know at what age they began their sexual relationship. So I think that you could make the case that any, 17-year-old boy having sex with an 11-year-old girl, whether it's against the law or not, is problematic, if not criminal. But I haven't heard anybody else suggest that as something that happened as opposed to something we ought to think about. So I can't really go there. I think it's your use of Frances Willard is really interesting. Yes, she did. She was a formidable woman. I think people think she was one of the most powerful women actually in the 19th century with the temperance union and woman suffrage and all that. But as far as the Lovings go, I can't speak to that because I don't have evidence for it. Your second question, I lost the tail end of it. But I think the question is sort of like what Gus was talking about with hypocrisy. You know, how can white supremacists who themselves have done all of these things for, you know, millennia be afraid of other people doing it to them? And I think the answer is in the question that people who've done those things, are the ones who can imagine that being done to them and it terrifies them.
Much obliged. Be in Toronto. W. Kamau Bell, he has a program on CNN where he talks about white supremacy racism. He's been a guest on The Cows, 2010. He is one person who talked, and in a not joking manner, someone who has told stand-up jokes and all the rest, spoke seriously in saying, wait a minute, you have a white man who's 17 and a black female who's 11, and this is supposed to be celebrated as a great union about equality. And he did the great thing. So if this was a 17-year-old black male and an 11-year-old white female, we would feel the same way. This case would have got to the Supreme Court and woohoo, right? Like we would have had the same respect. Even 2021, if it was that way, a 17-year-old black male and an 11-year-old black female, we would be, yes, this interracial, right. The caller, black male privilege. The caller, Mo in Dallas, did you have a question for Dr. Jane Daly?
Yes, I do. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Thank you. Greetings, Gus. Thank you for the program. Greetings, listeners.
Your volume is a little low. If you could project your voice, speak up, that would be helpful.
Okay, is this better?
Yes, sir.
Is that better, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Yes,
yes, sir.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Well, you just spoke on the Loving case, and you asked the inverse of that question, a black male, 17, white female, 11. So I had a question kind of in the same vicinity, if you would. When you asked the guest about Sally Hemings, she stated that Sally Hemings had feelings for Thomas Jefferson. Are you, and I was going to ask, was she aware of the age gap? And you did that, and she said, ah, sure. I think Sally Hemings was 14, and Thomas Jefferson was in his 30s, and she was a slave. So my question to the historian is, throughout your studies, have you ever found a black male in his 30s marrying a white female between the ages of, let's say, 14 and 16, in this big world?
Touche. I haven't looked for that. It's true. I don't know. You know, people. Yeah.
Especially if it was celebrated. But I didn't know.
I didn't hear what you said there. That's what I said. Project. I didn't hear what you said there, Dallas. Mo and Dallas.
Which? Oh.
I'm saying I'm sure that case, if it would be highly publicized or something like that, if it was in this, you know, we found out about Solomon Northup, and we do know about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. So I just would like to know if she came across a case like that.
No, I haven't come across any cases of black men in their 30s sort of marrying white teenagers.
Right on, Mo in Dallas. The black African, you did include in the text, I'll just read a little bit, the little portion on the Lovings. Richard Loving's family stood out for their disaffection for white supremacy. Richard's father worked as a truck driver for 23 years for Boyd Bird, a wealthy black farmer. Addicted to NASCAR, Richard formed a highly successful integrated drag racing team with two African-American friends who shared communal ownership of a car. In this context, nobody paid much attention when Richard, then age 17, began to date young Mildred Jeter, who traced her family along a bumpy genealogical route that included ancestors from three continents. As one of Mildred's uncles put the matter later, after the young couple had married, Richard isn't the first white man in our family, and he won't be the last. Which is interesting in and of itself in this context. In June 1958, when Richard was 24 and Mildred just 18, they decided to get married. I highlighted that because I said, man, I know the current statutory rape laws that we have, if you're 17, you cannot legally be engaged in sexual intercourse with someone who is more than 5 years older. So if Mildred had been 17, they, at least the way that the statutory rape laws in Washington state, they could not have gotten married, and this would be statutory rape. They would have to, I mean, it would have been have to wait by the calendar to make sure we're okay. But I thought that was interesting also because you gave Richard's age at 17. You just stated that Mildred was young, and then you gave both their ages, 24 and 18, when the case goes to marriage. That's why I said, like, I think even a lot of people would pause if it was stated 17,
mm-hmm.
11. There would be a pause, like, whoa, I don't know. Or at least let me think about this a little bit. Was there a reason that you didn't include her age? Because we got his age twice. We got hers only once.
No, you're right. There isn't a reason. I think you're absolutely right that 11 does make you pause. And I can't tell you why I did that the way that I did, except I may not have been aware at the time of exactly how young she was. But there's no defense. She was a kid and he was a teenager.
Right on. Reading is more important than watching television. Our guest, Dr. Jane Daly, the book White Fright, just out today. The Black African. Did you have a question for Dr. Daly? You should be with us, sir.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, I had a few questions. Dr. Daly, your quote, like your James Baldwin quote, like you said it was poignant, like I'm wondering if that was a joke, considering I think James Baldwin was gay. So, like, was that a joke?
No, sir. I don't think I said that. I don't think I said that James Baldwin's quote was poignant. I was talking then about Lewis Till and his son Emmett. So, no, I was not meaning to either make fun of, God forbid, of James Baldwin or of that, what he had to say at that time.
No, I think you said that James Baldwin was talking to a white person and or a white man, and he said that the white man would be afraid of James Baldwin having sex, I guess, with his daughter's daughter. I can't remember exactly, but it's not
James
Baldwin was saying that he was going to be having sex with females, but I don't think that's accurate.
Right.
Like, I thought it was, I thought you were joking at the time, because I'm like, I thought this guy is well known to be gay.
No, although, no, what James Baldwin was saying then was, this was, you know, a conversation about miscegenation, about sex across the color line, and this white man saying, we can't have that, right? You know, we can't have that. That's a terrible thing. And what Baldwin was saying was, listen, you know, you're not worried about black men. And here he may have said me, but he didn't mean him personally. But about black men having sex with your daughters, you have all of these daughters by black women because you've been, you know, raping them and sleeping with them for millennia now. You're worried about us marrying your wife's daughter, and your wife, who is the pure, you know, citadel of whiteness, who has never had sex with a black man, who would never consider having sex with a black man, her daughter is white. And that's what the white man is worried about. That's what James Baldwin was saying. So it's a complicated sentence because he wanted both to skewer the hypocrisy of the white man while also making clear, you know, which daughter the white man was concerned about.
When you said it's a big world, when you were talking about, I guess this was when, during so-called slavery time, where you, it sounded like you were saying that at, during this time, there wasn't white supremacy racism, that it was something else. Like the metaphor, it's a big world. I didn't understand it. Could you break that down?
Hmm. Yeah. What I meant was that there are lots, what I meant exactly, you know, lots of different stratum for people to be in, which does not mean that it wasn't a world free of white supremacy at all or racism, but that people were in different positions, so encountered that racism from different angles, so that a black man in New York who was a dock worker and who had, you know, a legal wife and a legal child lived in that world of white supremacy, but within his own household had his own systems of dependency and hierarchy and priority. That's what I meant by that. I didn't mean that these people weren't living in a world that was getting, you know, worse by the minute in the 19th century North even, but that within their own domestic relationships, they did have some of the attributes of, you know, fatherhood, of patriarchy, you know, of marriage.
So like who runs, like during that time, who controlled like black families?
Well, black families were autonomous, like other families in the North in this period. So I think, you know, the father and husband would say he controlled the black family.
Oh, okay. Just my last question real quick. I'm wondering, like your audience, like the people that read, because you had so many articles on your, and all kinds of writings. I'm wondering, like, what's your audience like demographically? And then, like the black people that listen to you or read your work, like, do they tell you that they're confused by what you're saying, like, afterwards? Because you've, like, definitely confused me today. So, like, what do the black people say that read your work or listen to you?
Well, I don't know, because they haven't always told me. I think this book is brand new, so I think you may be, you know, you get to be my first confused reader. The book was written for
not the book, like all of your stuff.
Oh, all of my work.
Yeah.
Well, it's all written, I guess, for the same people who are interested in, you know, American history and in African American history and in really the history, you know, the tortuous tale of white supremacy in this country.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Much obliged. The Black African, the number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Before we nab our caller in Ohio. What do you make of that hypocrisy? We had Dr. Carolyn West on the program. I mean, you documented centuries. Even we got, this is, I think, in the last 10 days, Dr. Daly's book is the third reference to D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. Third reference in the last 10 days amongst our guests on the program. Cased, I mean, wow. Gus the Renegade has starred on The Cows in November of 2020. If you haven't seen Birth of a Nation or read, there is a reason Gus T. Renegade was picked. That right there, three times in 10 days, I was stunned. We're not really, how can you be stunned? Anyway, what do you make of the hypocrisy? You have whole campaigns. That's the premise of Birth of a Nation. We've got the raping black male, and she jumps off a cliff in order to stop from being raped. And Strom Thurmond, and Senator Bilbo, and all of the, I mean, just for centuries, all of this. And then Dr. Carolyn West says one of, if not easily the most popular genres of pornography is interracial porn. Black male having sex, degrading sex with a white female, and or as she said, a white man in a Klan outfit having sexual intercourse with a black female or a black male. What do you make of that lie, that hypocrisy?
I don't know. I was amazed listening to that, you know, the clip that you played earlier, and especially the guy wearing, like, dressed in Confederate flags or something. What are you going to do with this stuff? Hypocrisy is interesting in and of itself, meaning that it's lying, as you say. It's a special kind of lying. It's a kind of lying that has a really big moral charge. We don't like hypocrites. You know, calling somebody a hypocrite is worse than calling them a liar a lot of the time. It's, you know, saying you know, you're doing what you tell everybody not to do. That's hypocritical, and that's worse than just saying you're not doing it. So yes, the South is not just the South, the nation, you know, our racial past is littered with I can't even find good language for it to express how much hypocrisy there has been around this question.
Absolutely. That would be one point, because it's so common. And again, some of the points that I'm making in terms of the pussyfooting, deception, that's one of the major tools of maintaining the system of white supremacy is deception. As I said, that deception takes many forms. Hypocrisy, not answering questions, deliberately concealing information, all of that counts as deception. And one of the points of deception, we on this program, we emphasize global system of white supremacy. Our first caller was B in Toronto, where they also have these same, whatever you want to call it, lies and sexual terrorism and exploitation of black people. And this is worldwide. I said I could have swapped out the Zoom clip. We just had our caller in Austria who said the same thing. They disrupted the Zoom meeting with the penises.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Oh, yeah, let's get, what do you make of that? Because that's the exact same thing. Why is it globally we got all these penises and niggers and swastikas?
I mean, that's the quote of the day, I think. I don't know. You know, again, there's a really long history, and I'm not good enough to talk about this, of, you know, a history of sexual exploitation and otherness. So meaning, like, white Christian fantasies that Jews are going to come and, you know, rape their daughters and that kind of, you know. So penises are often involved in various campaigns of supremacy. Don't quote me on that one.
You don't have any other, in terms of analysis and how this correlates to your work in White Fright? And it's not just penises, it's penises and specifically penises, swastikas, penises, nigra, worldwide, in terms of why would this sort of thing be happening? And in the midst of a global health crisis, why would this become a favorite pastime, presumably of white people worldwide?
It's a good question. You know, one thing that I know is true about the White South is that the rest of the world looks, or people,
I'm going to get this right. It's too late in the day to take on swastikas and white supremacy in America. But there's a fascination with the Confederacy and with Confederate symbols. So you see, you know, Confederate battle flags in Austria. You see them in East Germany. And these symbols mingle, you know, the Confederate battle flag, the swastika, you know, penises, you know, racist language, to get at what seem to be kind of universal white terrors of sex across boundaries and the politics of that.
We'll have to process. The point I was getting at before I had to get my question in about the penises and the Zoom conferences, and it came up again in your response there in terms of the world looking to the South. There's a tendency to locate white supremacy, racism in the South, and that comes through greatly in your text, focusing on the South's concerns around these issues as though they are not the case in other parts of the world, much less the country. And I thought specifically with the terrorism that was spoken about against some of the black troops and what have you. And I said, man, she's in Chicago. I am so glad we read Packing Them In, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington's book on environmental racism in Chicago. And she was a guest on our program on Earth Day, no less. We had amazing timing with her, too. The thing is, that book, she talks a lot about terrorism in Chicago specifically and the bombing campaigns against black people, black families who tried to move to a different area. And I remember I even said, whoa, whoa, whoa. That is important, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington, Environmental Racism in the Book Club. And she was a guest Earth Day this year. But I said, man, Dr. King said the worst racism I experienced was not in the South, was not in Mississippi, not in Georgia or Alabama, exactly where Dr. Daly is, Chicago. And I think that is huge. Like, I think any time that we make an analysis of white supremacy racism, it should not be localized to the South, localized to the United States. It is a global system of racism. Do you think you could have expanded your text to do more of including, because these folks, you did get California, I make sure get that in, she does include California, but I just said the governor in New England, Governor LePage, about them coming to rape white women, to do more to include the at least national, much further than the Mason-Dixon line.
Sure, you're right, obviously. You know, other parts of the rest of the United States. Hawaii is the one part that I talk about that isn't quite of the same regime, but that is why I brought in California, because you don't think Mississippi and California are in the same category. But they were when it came down to anti-miscegenation laws. And so that was the comparison I wanted to make, and I wanted to look at that part of the country that people might think is, way too enlightened to be like that, to have segregated schools. You know, California schools were segregated too, as were lots of other states like Arizona and others. But it was a big story, and the trick was finding the way to tell it, in a more distilled way, rather than, you know, telling the story for each part of the country. Because I could have written probably 50 books on this topic for each state.
Global system. Again, James Lowen said there were more sundown towns above the Mason-Dixon line than below. Caller in Ohio, did you have a question?
I was just going to say that, you know, Jim's absolutely right about that, and it's important not to think that white supremacy and slavery are synonymous in any way. That, you know, it shouldn't surprise us that there are more sundown towns in the North and in the South, because for one reason, there are more towns in the North. But also, the idea that white supremacy stayed in the South after the war is completely wrong. And I think you're right to really stress that.
Global system. Our first caller be in Toronto. You're supposed to be there for the retreat. Caller in Ohio. You should be ready to roll, sir.
Can you hear me? Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and callers and listeners, and Dr. Daly. My question was, why did you begin your book with the story about Emily Reed and the wedding story about the rabbits.
What, do you think it was a bad beginning?
No, I was just curious why you began with that story. What was your reason?
My reason was, I guess, it was a story I came across early on in doing this book. And I liked Miss Reed. I liked the way that she kind of stood up to folks. And she really, despite them, then put the Martin Luther King Striding Towards Freedom book also on the recommended reading list shortly before she left the state and went, I think, back to Virginia. But I thought, in some sense, it gives a sense of the what readers might think of as absurdity of the anxiety about interracial sex, you know, by having this children's book be about rabbits and all these people in Alabama getting all up in arms saying anybody who reads this children's book is immediately going to, you know, run out and break our miscegenation laws. So I thought it did a lot of work for me at the very beginning of the book.
Now, my understanding is that this was a story from the 1950s.
Yes.
And this was a woman who was classified as white living in Indiana.
She was from Indiana,
and
then her
Alabama.
Job was in. Exactly.
And she was surprised that the people in Indiana, in Alabama, objected to a children's book where a black and a white rabbit got married.
Yes.
And this woman was surprised.
Yes, and I hear what you're saying, Indiana. We might as well consider Indiana part of the South. But she was.
Indiana.
I think she was.
I live in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
I could tell you, a white woman in 2021, if there was a children's book where a black and a white rabbit got married, they would understand the symbolism.
Oh, no, she didn't. It's not that she didn't understand the symbolism. She understood the symbolism perfectly well. She was surprised that, you know, the Alabama state legislature would go so far as to try and keep her from putting the book on the shelves. No, she knew why they were upset about it. She just thought that the book should be free for people to read. She didn't know. She absolutely understood the problem from white Alabama's point of view with the book.
But she was surprised by that.
She was surprised by the ferocity of it, I think.
I don't know. It just struck me as the story just struck me as not really ringing true. That she would be surprised.
Mm-hmm. No, I can see why you would think that.
Particularly a white woman in the 1950s in Indiana.
Well, you know, she was pretty liberal in her politics. So I think that maybe I shouldn't have said surprised. I think she was being, she thought she was being not naughty. That's not fair because it's too important. I think she knew that she was pushing against the society that she found herself in when she made a stand on this book.
Okay, so more accurately, it would be that she was provocative.
Yes, she was very provocative. But again, I'm not sure that she provoked it so much as once she just sort of put the book on the shelf and there was this uproar, then she dug in her heels.
So again, my question again is, why did you begin your book with this? So the context is that this was a woman who you felt was liberal.
Yes.
And what were you trying to say about white women?
I wasn't trying to say anything about white women as a group. I was trying to tell the story of this woman and what she did in Alabama, and to try to engage the reader into thinking, whoa, you know, who cares? Wow, these people went nuts over a children's story, as a way to then try and, you know, get into the bigger subject of the book. I wasn't making any statement about, you know, all white women in the 1950s, or even, you know, white Indiana women in the 1950s. I was really just trying to talk about Emily Reed, who was an individual.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it, guys.
Sir, thank you for reading the book.
Much obliged, sir. Let's see. I was going to get Rob in California, and he disappeared. I had his I guess he'll ring back. Let's see. Our caller in New Jersey. Did you have a question for Dr. Daly?
Yes. Good evening. How you doing, Professor? Yes, hello?
We can hear you. I can hear you. Dr. Daly, can you hear caller in New Jersey?
Okay.
Yes, I can.
Okay. Yeah, so I have a question first. Would you consider yourself liberal?
You know, we could have a long conversation about what that word means at different, you know, points in time in the past, today. I don't really know what I would consider myself in those terms. I voted for Biden.
Okay.
Does that, you know, that makes
me
liberal?
Okay. No, I just asked that question because that's the language of today, you know, conservative, liberal. And normally liberal is synonymous with, you know, just kind of like being friends of black people. With that being said, in the media, there's a narrative pushed of anti-education in the black community. And it was just stated, you stated that you know, black people after slavery, Reconstruction, going into Jim Crow, were very serious about their literacy rates and becoming educated. So if liberals is classified as being friends of black people, why when the media pushes the narrative of anti-education in the black community, coming from black people, why doesn't liberals push back? Why aren't they loud to really kind of like push the history of black people striving for education in the United States?
That's a really interesting question. Probably because they don't know. Again, one of the things that the, you know, white supremacist version of American history did for so many years was to say that black people didn't care about education, and that, you know, black children didn't, you know, at all. And so that's one reason why I think it's so important to just to stress all of the time how important education was for the freed people. And when I started out as a historian and I was looking at this interracial coalition in Virginia in the 1880s, the conclusion I came to was that what made the coalition possible between African Americans in Virginia and white Virginians who had been Democrats was they all wanted free public schools. And that desire was enough to pull white Democrats out of their party and to ally with people who they thought were completely inferior. They were complete white supremacists. But they came out of their own party to ally with African Americans because what they wanted were schools.
and they wanted them that badly. And so I always am struck by this. And it's a line that the kind of racist, you know, white supremacist histories of the South in particular from the 1930s and 40s and 50s and, you know, beyond in some respects, they didn't tell that story. That is the story. And I think you're right that should be the story that, you know, black people in this country have always strived for education and fought for education. And they're still doing it.
So do you think that, so do you think liberal and conservative, white liberals and conservative are guilty of practicing racism when they push this narrative, especially when we talk about, deprived areas with, not so good school system. So you think it's racist on liberals and conservatives' part that they kind of double down on this narrative that, you know, blacks are just kind of like inherently anti-intellectual or anti-education?
Yeah. I hope that liberals don't do that. That's not an argument I've heard myself. So I don't know, you know, who's making that argument, although I'm sure that people are. And if they're making that argument, yes, it's a racist argument, because to assume that any group isn't interested in education, whether they're, you know, immigrants or African-Americans, has got to be coming from a racist place.
Okay, I got you. But liberals don't. But liberals don't put it in its proper context. So, so that would be considered them also practicing racism. They don't.
Yeah,
they don't,
I mean, I think
they don't put the his. They don't his. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I think you're right that you know, we talk about lying by omission, right? Leaving something out that's important, and I think that if you do that in this instance, that it's racist. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Context of white supremacy. Now we got Robert in California. Did you have a question for Dr. Daly?
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
greetings to Gus, hosts, listeners, and callers, and thank the guests for being on the program. I just have one question. So in conducting conversations in the context of white supremacy and pointing out the terror that white men have inflicted on the globe, you being a white woman, do you feel that you have to be in defense of white men because your father is white and that you may have white uncles and or white male children?
No, definitely not. I don't feel like – I think white men can defend themselves just fine, and they don't need me to defend them. And as for, you know, my father and my children being white, that much is true, but I also have actually two African-American granddaughters. So our family is a little mixed up, and that's an important thing. And no, I don't speak for white men or, you know, the actions that they've taken.
The fact that, well, that's a statement, so I won't go there. The next question that I have is that, do you know or do you suspect why I'm asking you that question right now, this evening?
Well, I see you think that I'm an apologist for white supremacists.
I don't think I said that. I asked you a question.
Well, you asked me why I thought you asked the question.
Okay. So, no, I don't feel that you're an apologist for white supremacists. That's not what I feel. I'm asking you that question based on the amount of laughter that I've heard you exhibit on the program this evening, And, like, I haven't heard anything funny this evening. And so I question if you are taking the conversation serious. And that, let me put that in the form of a question.
Mm-hmm.
Are you taking this conversation serious this evening?
I am indeed. And I apologize if I've given the impression that I'm not. I'm kind of a person who laughs a lot or makes sounds like that. And so I do apologize if it's come across that way. No, there's nothing funny about this topic. There's nothing funny about it in the past. There's nothing funny about it today. And, you know, immersing oneself in this topic is also not a funny experience.
Okay. And so I would just like to say that, you know, I'm not stating that you aren't taking the conversation serious. I'm just making an observation.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for being on the program this evening.
Thank you for your question.
Much obliged, Rob in California. Before we let you enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening, I had a few more questions just directly from the text, White Fright, just published officially today. This is on page 217. You're writing about some of the more organized campaigns in response to Brown v. Board of Education, and oh no, we might have our little white girls in school with these little black boys and all the rest of it. This is on page 217. You write, between June 1954 and May 1955, when the Supreme Court issued Brown II, the White Citizens Council concerned itself chiefly with building its organizational base and harassing local African Americans. These pillars of the white community did nothing violent or ugly, nothing that would strain their consciences on Sunday. They simply used the weapons at hand, which, since many of them were bankers and businessmen, included economic intimidation. When he came to the attention of the WCC, White Citizens Council, for example, NAACP leader Ainsley Moore, a World War II veteran and one of the most influential black men in Mississippi, suddenly found the mortgages on his house and service station called by the bank that held them. You go on to give more of the flagrant acts of white terrorism, the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission and their efforts.
Yes.
When you say these pillars of the white community did nothing violent or ugly, what do you mean exactly?
What I mean was that they didn't do some of the things that they did later on, like you know, kidnapping a black man at random and castrating him and sending his testicles to Roy Shuttlesworth in a cup. So there were horrible, horrible things that the White Citizens Council did. They didn't do that right then. And so maybe I think you and your audience are calling me out on my tone quite a bit. And that's probably fair and interesting to me as a writer. Again, when I said something like, you know, they're not going to strain their consciences on Sunday, I was trying to be ironic and say they were doing all kinds of horrible things that they thought were restrained. Like, well, we're not, you know, burning up anybody's tobacco. You know, we're not firebombing the barn, which is something that they do later.
And nothing that would strain their consciences on Sunday. And I would submit, just judging by the tone of the white killers who gloated about killing Emmett Till, their consciences didn't seem all that disturbed either. Nor did,
no,
I don't know, Senator Bilbo, Dylann Roof. It'd be difficult for me to point to a white supremacist who, what did I say at that quote, often sincerely and greatly pained about racism. That was the quote we started this with. Anywho, but be that as it may with the last portion, I think it's important. Violence. What is upholding the system of white supremacy? Deception, that's number one, and violence. And I think there are, just like there are many different types of deception, there are many different types of violence. And I mean, certainly, castrating someone and direct lynchings and dismemberments, which you talk about some of those in detail in the book, which is super important. That, absolutely. Terrorism and violence. But I mean, if you all of a sudden find your mortgage and service station called, that is for sure violence. Like Rosa Parks, they'll gloat and talk about what she did on the bus and all that. They totally leave out the economic terrorism that she experienced that is just like what happened to Ames. There's a reason she did not ride out her life in civil rights glory in Alabama. There's a reason she was in Michigan, and that's violence. And I think that's very important because white people find lots of different ways of obfuscating. That's that deception again, where things that are violent, they don't get called that. Even in my view, Flint, that is violence. Doesn't get regarded
that
way.
That's the point I was trying to make, but I made it in an ironic tone. But yes, having your mortgage called is economic intimidation and violence, and they do that right away. And Rosa Parks lost all of her clients, you know, as a seamstress, except for Virginia Durer.
And not just she, her entire family was terrorized and endured that sort of economic violence and not being able to get a job and employment and being total terrorism, violence. You write, this is a little bit further down on 231, racial extremists like Bilbo, were not the only people who believed this. Evidence of the political and social influence. Oh, this is, let me make sure I get in the full quote because this is, give it all the time, the religion of white supremacy. Let me give it to you the full context. A Virginia minister was more explicit as he lectured shortly after the Brown decision, spurning and rejecting the plain truth of the word of God has always resulted in the judgment of God. Man, in overstepping the boundary lines God has drawn, has taken another step in the direction of inviting the judgment of Almighty God. This step of racial integration is but another stepping stone toward the gross immorality and lawlessness that will be the characteristic of the last days just preceding the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. If this happened, it would be the fault of no one but white Southern Christians themselves, for did not the Bible make clear, as Mississippi Senator Theodore G. Bilbo warned in 1946, that miscegenation and amalgamation are sins of man in the direct defiance with the will of God. Racial extremists like Bilbo were not the only people who believed this. Evidence of the political and social influence of these ideas is everywhere. I'll stop there. The religion of white supremacy. Just can you talk? I won't read it, but she talks about they have one version of what happened, the original sin in the Garden of Eden. It wasn't a serpent. It was a Negro gardener. I howled laughing, having never heard that one before. But all seriousness, the religion of white supremacy. Just can you talk about the role of using the religion of white supremacy to enforce racism and specifically about sex?
Yes. You know, when we think about the religious history of the civil rights movement, what we think about, generally speaking, is Dr. King. And, you know, the SCLC and the movement for equality and for, you know, the beautiful community. And this is all true. And that's really kind of the winning argument. But in the South, there was an equally strong argument on the side of many white Southern Christians that, you know, was anti-civil rights, on the basis that, again,
the vote will lead to, you know, marriage and sex, et cetera, and that that was against God's will, and that God had divided, you know, the world, the earth, into its sections, and everybody had their place, you know, and the black people were supposed to stay in Africa, and the, you know, white people were supposed to be in Europe, and the American Indians were supposed to still have America. And but for man's sinfulness, that would have worked out just fine. But, you know, man misbehaved and mixed everybody up and had sex, you know, with everybody, and that is a violation of God's will. And this was a very serious argument. And when I first started writing about it, it was really interesting, because the civil rights, you know, version of universal brotherhood Christianity was so strong that it was hard to imagine that anybody could have really believed, you know, in this other kind of white supremacist Christianity, but they did.
Hard to believe. In fact, wait
a
minute.
People said that.
Go ahead.
When I first started presenting, people, my audience would say, "Oh, but they couldn't possibly have really believed that, did they?" And it was really frustrating, because you'd say, "Yes, they did believe this," but you know, no. It was very interesting reaction from people about whether or not anybody in their right mind could believe this stuff, when they thought they could believe all kinds of other things, but not this.
White people do a lot of lying. There's lots of evidence, and particularly when it comes to talking about racism. Dr. King said some years ago, the most segregated hour in America is on Sunday morning. He didn't say Sunday morning in the South, or Sunday morning in Mississippi, or Sunday morning in Alabama. I'm not sure how much has, well, I know with schools, I know they've said absolutely that nothing has changed with regards to schools and so-called segregation, if not things have gotten worse. So it would be hard for me to imagine things have improved that much on Sunday morning. So I would say the evidence, I would have to, what they call it, the young people, they say the side eye to a white person who tells me they find it hard to believe that, and we would be probably talking about maybe their grandparents, who might even still be alive, had these type of views. Mm-hmm. Like, how honest, but, you know, either way, what do you mean when you say racial extremists? Because that's how you referenced Mr. Bilbo, former Senator Mr. Bilbo.
Yes. Well, I guess, I you know, you have to differentiate among your racists, right? So you have your racists who are themselves reformers, who would never believe, like Will Alexander, for example, is somebody who was, you know, worked with a number of organizations, including the NAACP, including the Federal Council of Churches, never would have believed that he himself could possibly be a racist. He's kind of on one end. And then you have people like Bilbo or like Ben Tillman, who are, I think, more extreme in their racism, or straightforward in their racism. In some sense, they're more honest because they acknowledge their racism, but they are the ones who are usually pushing the violence, pushing disenfranchisement. So that's what I mean there. I mean, trying to find a way within, like, a whole group of people. I mean, I got pushback by saying that people, you know, the people who thought they were Southern liberals were white supremacists. That wasn't an argument that people wanted to hear. I had someone in an audience stand up and say, "Are you saying that my father, who, you know, who was in CORE, was a white supremacist?" And the answer was kind of yes, probably, sort of, depending on how you understand it. So that's, you know, when I'm trying to differentiate, you know, there's a difference between Will Alexander and Bilbo, and I have to make that, you know, be able to make that distinction without obfuscating either one of them.
That's interesting. I just, with the term racial extreme, and I guess for my perspective as a victim of white supremacy, I don't know that there's a difference. Who knows what people do when they get in the voting booth? White people do a lot of deceptive things. That's one. For two, and that's just following logic. For two, when we say that this person is a so-called racial extremist, particularly, we're not talking about like a 1-2 Klansman. who's out, you know, in a barn or a shack and talking about nigra this and nigra that. We're talking about someone who served in the United States Senate for a substantial number of terms. Same thing, mm-hmm. Ben Tillman. We're not talking about someone who just was on a farm in South Carolina being rowdy. No, this was a governor. This was a U.S. senator. This was a presidential mm-hmm. candidate. So when we say this person is extreme, you have to get elected. That means you would have to have, like, not 5 or 10 followers. You would have to have, like, tens of thousands of white people who say, yeah, that Bilbo speaks for me. Go out there and represent us in Washington. Yeah, pitchfork Ben Tillman.
Pitchfork, yes.
Get out and represent us. Hold it down for South Carolina. That's not extreme. It's language that is not representing the widespread nature of white supremacy, racism, and particularly if we want to talk about these folks as extremists, well, apparently that has widespread appeal.
Right. I mean, I think you can be extreme and still mainstream in these communities.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
I think it's in a system of racism, white supremacy. Again, we do a lot of this person is a racial extremist. This person is a racial mm-hmm. moderate. If we're in a system of racism, white supremacy, we're not even saying that he's a racist, a racial extremist. Why not just say he's a racist? We got this person is a racist. This person is a racist. This person is expressing a more extreme brand, whatever that is, of white supremacy, race. Mm-hmm. I mean, even that, like, even hearing that, like, what does that mean? Like, I don't really know what that means. So I'm going to lynch 3 black people. Today, maybe we'll only lynch 1 black person. Maybe we'll only put you in jail. I mean, yeah. Anyway. And I do a lot, like I said, words are very important because a lot of times white people do not use the most accurate terms when it comes to white supremacy, racism, and that mm-hmm. generates a lot of problems. In fact, you have a whole title in your text, Death Groans from a Dying System. I thought, wow, what does that mean? Why did you title the whole chapter that?
Is that the last? No, that's not the
14,
next to
chapter
last.
14.
I did. Well, I titled it that in part because it was in the quote, right, from sources. And so I thought it would be a useful title. But also, there's irony there. You know, civil rights workers wanted to think that a lot of this furor in the 60s was maybe the death groans of a dying system. You know, maybe we've succeeded in killing it. And I think you know the answer to that. Which is they didn't.
For sure. I hear lots of suggestions that racism is over at different times. Clearly it is not. Again, causing confusion. There is, I guess, a component of heteronormativity in the text. I really appreciate mm-hmm. Vincent Woodard's, it's in my top 10, The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption, mm-hmm. and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture. All of mm-hmm. the white fetishism of black sexuality. It is not just white males and black females. It's white males mm-hmm. and black males. It's white males and black children, male or female. Mm-hmm. It's white women and black females. It's white women and black males. It's white women and children. Like, that dynamic is super, super broad. And I think a lot of these conversations, they totally ignore. And particularly when we present it in this manner, it leaves out black males as also being victims of this sexual terrorism, which absolutely happened. In fact, I think Dr. Curry, Vincent Woodard, in their work, they ask us to think of a lot of these acts of racism and violence against black males even as homoerotic acts. If you're lynching and carving off someone's genitals and what have you, and a lot of these acts, they're stripping the body nude and what have you, that even these mm-hmm. should be thought about in a homoerotic, sexual, absolutely racist sense. Can you address why more of that component wasn't included in the text?
It wasn't included in the text more. I wish I could have. You know, it's a really interesting topic. But if you look at some of the, there's a Ralph Ellison short story, and then I think maybe also a Faulkner short story, but basically the same story, which is a white man tossing and turning in bed the night before a lynching. And he can't get an erection, and it goes from there. And so it's very clear. I mean, and I always feel that the novelists for a long time have got this part of Southern history a lot better than historians did. And I think you're absolutely right about the sexual relationships under slavery. I mean, one reason there hasn't been a lot of work on that is it's really hard to find the evidence. I remember my own dissertation advisor, Nellervin Painter, was looking for this. Specifically, she was looking for white, you know, relationships between white male planters and black male slaves, because every slave civilization in the world has had those relationships. And historians had not found those relationships in the United States. And she thought that this was wrong, probably. But she was having a hard time finding historical sources for it. So sometimes I feel like there's a difference between knowing as a historian and knowing in your gut. And here's where I think the Southern novelists do it for me.
I'm reminded, like, wow, this has become a whole little... The Cows has been here for 12 years, so what have you done for your 12 years? So Dr. Nellervin Painter, 2010, we talked about her book, The History of White People, and specifically
people.
We talked about the history of white people and homoeroticism going all the way back to Europe, and including children, because I think that's so important when we talk about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Heming, when we talk about Mildred and the Loving Case, white people and the history of taking sexual advantage of and raping children. Dr. Nellervin Painter, she has that in her book. That's a big section. That is a big part, and that has certainly been visited on black people. That's the context that that's why I say, hey, she puts in the Loving Case, this white fella is 17, but we're not going to say that Mildred is 11? Like, come on. Like, yeah. Anyway, and... Rethinking Rufus, Thomas A. Foster, his book is all about the history. And he's an Illinois Lowless. I think he's right where you are. That's what his book is all about, the history of sexual violence against black males specifically and how that's been excluded. His book was just published last year. He was a guest on the program at the end of the year. I'll make sure. Did I miss anybody, any of the listeners, before we let Dr. Daly enjoy the rest of her? Oh, I did. Non-Clemson grad. Oh, wait a minute. Thomas in New York. No. Sorry, got it incorrect. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Dr. Daly?
I do, Gus. Good evening. I wasn't able to hear the beginning, so I hope my question, I have a few questions. Hopefully I can get them all in. Doctor, good evening. Did you see any of the riots? Oh, yes. Did you see any of the riots and protests this summer?
Of course.
Okay. I watched them too, and I was a little confused. Who is Black Lives Matter? Are they black people or are they white people?
Well, they should be everybody.
Okay. Do you think that it could be construed that the white people who were marching and chanting Black Lives Matter and destroying property, that could be looked at as a form of racism?
I was in Chicago. I live right near where the marches were. I was in one of the marches. There was a feeling in Chicago that the people who looted and destroyed property were not chanting Black Lives Matter, that they had come specifically to loot. So we in Chicago, at least, were differentiating between, you know, the marchers and the people who broke into the stores.
Were the people who looted, were they black or white?
I think the footage that one saw on the news was mostly of black people. So I would just say that that was the image, certainly, that was given.
Okay. Do you think that if these protests and riots had happened and it was only black people, do you think the response would have been different from law enforcement?
You mean if during the Black Lives Matter protests there hadn't been all those white people there too?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's really an interesting question.
Even like in Portland, where you still have people in the streets, probably not now, but, you know, a couple weeks ago, Seattle, they created their own autonomous zone separate from the United States. Like, do you think that would have been allowed to happen if that was black people?
In a word, probably no. And it's interesting. Your question is really interesting because it goes right back to, you know, the civil rights strategists in the 1960s when CORE and SNCC sent white people into Alabama and Mississippi because they thought, they hoped that people wouldn't get killed if there were white people there too. And or if people did get killed, then other people would pay attention. And so I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right that there would have been a much more ferocious police reaction if it had only been black people chanting Black Lives Matter, and it would not have been portrayed as a peaceful, you know, a peaceful civil protest.
Okay. Do you think, and I'm not sure these questions were asked, do you think that Donald Trump is a racist?
Yeah, I'm trying to find the, you know, strong enough language to say that. Yes.
Well,
yes, and the
Joe
people
Biden?
Who voted for him knew he was. Joe Biden is harder. I think he's not noxious. You know, I think, what do I want to say about Joe Biden? I would say Joe Biden was a racist in 1974, for sure, when he voted against school busing. He had no other reason to do that than race. He was probably still racist in the 90s when he was, you know, pushing for the crime bill. I like to think that people change, and so maybe he's less of a racist today. I think he's definitely less of a racist. I think, you know, I trust Kamala Harris enough that she wouldn't have run with someone who she thought was racist.
Wow. What about Trump's racism appeal to white women? In both elections at more of a rate than, the other opponent. Even with the first time against Hillary, a white woman, more white women voted for Trump, and he got more of the white woman vote this time.
Yes, he did. I don't know, you know. the white women thing is disappointing. We don't know why they voted for him yet. But you have to assume that some of them, you know, lots of them voted because they like what he says about black people and, you know, about immigrants as, you know, all criminals and keep them out. So that's appealing to women as well as men. I think people who think that women are going to be, I don't know, morally better than men on that regard are wrong.
Okay. Well, thank you, Gus. And thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Much obliged. Our last caller, retired firefighter in Florida. Did you have a question for Dr. Daly? Retired firefighter in Florida, did you mute your line? Or?
Yes. I didn't know I was on mute. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. To the guests, you write books, make speeches, and I heard you state that you have two non-white black female grandchildren. Should non-white people under the global system of racism, white supremacy still suspect you for being a racist?
Of course they should. I mean, the reproductive choices of my daughter-in-law don't say anything about my own complicity in racism. So, yes. And I guess I shouldn't have played the black grandchildren card probably. But, you know, having them in my life does make me think about things differently. It doesn't make me not a racist, but it sure clarifies a lot of things.
My second question is, what do you think non-white people should get out of reading your you write more than one book? You written one more than one book? I don't know. I just got on the program.
Yes, sir.
What do you want? What do you want non-white black people to get out of from reading your books?
Wow. I guess I would like them. You know what? I don't have an answer for that question. I've never kind of broken up my audience in that way. You know, when you're writing a book like this, your editor says, well, what is the reader this and the reader that? And you don't think, well, am I speaking to a woman here? Am I speaking to a man there? So honestly, I can't answer that question.
I mean, you write about racism, white supremacy, right?
Yes.
Okay. Suspecting that, you know, that non-white people are going to read your books. You know,
I hope so.
I just figured that just as quick as you gave the answer, the previous answer, I would figure you would have had a pretty quick answer to the second question also.
Yeah. I mean, I think.
Expecting that they were going to read the book. I mean, you know. Anyway.
I would say that one thing.
Those are my two questions.
I appreciate that. I would say one thing I try to do in the book is to help people understand white supremacy without liking it, right? Or you know, saying it's a good thing, but saying it's a belief system. And I guess I would say if we want to try to eradicate it, we have to know what it is first. And that this was my attempt to explain white supremacy to my readers and the connections between sex and white supremacy in particular, to try to unravel it and, I don't know, make it seem like if we understood what it was in the past, maybe we can deal with it better in the present.
Much obliged.
Okay.
Retired firefighter in Florida. A mom in Michigan, she wanted to know, Dr. Daly, who do you think is more confused about racism, white supremacy, meaning what it is, how it works? Who do you think is more confused about that, white people or non-white people?
there's probably room for confusion on both sides. I would say that white people, though, in general, need to have it spelled out. You know, need to have, there's a system, there are power dynamics, there are mechanisms, there's a history, there's a language. So I would say that probably non-whites certainly know most of those categories. They may not know the history of it as much, but they know it when they see it and they can articulate how it works. And that's something that it would be good if more white people knew how to do.
Okay. Who were the, when you mentioned before about the archivists who can help you get information when you're going and doing your research and what have you, in your experience, were the archivists generally white people or non-white people?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it depends on the collections. I would say when I started out as a historian, the archivists were basically uniformly white people. It's a very white profession, like librarians. But then as I expanded into more African-American history and went to places like the Schomburg Library in New York, for example, then you had a much, you know, greater spectrum of archivists, and it wasn't only white people.
Hmm. Not a whole lot of Schomburg centers, I don't think.
No, there aren't. I'm thinking, you know, we have the DuSable here in Chicago, which is another collection. But, and I can't tell you. I assume that there are, you know, archivists in other places that I don't know about, who may or may not be, you know, the African Americans. But if your underlying question is, does it matter who the archivist is? Then I think the answer is yes.
They'll fuss at me. We had one of our female moms. She dialed in super late. Let's see. Can we get her question in real quick? Our female caller, did you have a Quick question, Dr. Daly, you should be with us.
Yes. Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Doctor. I came in a bit late, but I was curious about this question. The book that you wrote, I think it's called White Fright. And I think you said what I'm reading here, the book is about Black sexual, the intense fear of Black sexuality. And the question I want to ask is, why are white people afraid of Black sexuality? And bringing it into how, as I think Gus mentioned earlier, how white people have raped men, women, and children. So what is this intense fear about? If you could explain that to me.
Yes. So in the book, mostly what I try to do is explain how this fear worked rather than the origins of the fear. So in other words, how this fear worked in politics mostly. But I'll say that I think that you kind of answered your own question when you said that white people, and Du Bois says this at some point in the book, that white people have just basically have raped the entire world and spread their seed everywhere. And there is, I think, some fear that there is a just God and that will be come back to haunt whites. But I think probably in the end, it's a lot just about inversion, meaning they don't want to lose the power that they have. And there's a sexual component and there are other components. But again, we've talked a lot about power tonight. And the white people in this story know that they're operating within a system of white supremacy, and they like that, and they want to keep that. And the sexualized aspects of it help to prop that system up, but also reveal, I think you're absolutely right, a kind of a sexual, not even fear, fright, anxiety about black sexuality.
I don't think you answered my question. I don't think so either. Do you think you could, you know, give it a second go? If you can really think about the origins of this fear. Where did this fear come from? What is the fear about? If you could tell me that.
Well, one question to ask is, it's not clear to me that white women have this fear. And that was one of the fears of white men, meaning that white men worried a lot that white women were insufficiently afraid of black men and, you know, in fact, found them attractive. So I think we have to gender the question from the start and say, we don't have a lot of evidence. We have white women ginning up fear, like the bit from To Kill a Mockingbird that Gus played at the beginning, participating. I don't want to absolve white women of participation in white supremacy, but it's really a white male obsession. And as I talk about in the book, one of the interesting things about it is that it's new. It happens with emancipation. So that historians of slavery have gone back looking for, you know, white obsession with race purity and not found it. Meaning that, as we know, lots of masters had sex with slaves. And Eugene Genovese, who was one of the greatest historians of slavery, was the one to first say, all of this worry about, you know, rape and white men saying we got to keep everything pure, that only happens when black people are free and living in a world in which they have rights. So that's in part the story that I'm trying to tell, to show how this fear is connected to emancipation and black freedom and black participation in government.
I see you tried your best. I will not push any further. Thank you for attempting to answer my question.
I appreciate it.
Grand. Glad she was able to get her question in. Mo in Dallas, were you satisfied? Just make sure we didn't, everybody's grand so we can.
I had a quick question.
Yes, sir.
If I can be heard.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask the guest if she, did she learn anything on this program? And if she did, what did she learn? But that's all I had.
That's a very good question. Yes, indeed. I was just sitting here thinking of all the different things I learned on this program. How to think about my audience, how to anticipate what some of the different ways that the same question might be articulated and to make sure to have a good answer for it, and always to convey the really complete seriousness of the topic. That was a surprise to me to hear that I came across differently than I meant to, and I would never want to do that again. So I've learned a number of good lessons.
Rob in California, did you have your last question you wanted to get in? Rob in California.
Yes, sir. So I heard you state that you shouldn't have played the race card with your grandchildren. Now, for me, that statement was a bit of an eye-opener. And my question is, do you see, like, under the context of white supremacy, with white people having a greater power dynamic than non-white people, do you see anything incorrect about white people having sex with black people?
I don't think there's anything intrinsically incorrect. I mean, I hear what you're saying, that within our, you know, racially structured system, is there a way for white people to have sex with black people that is not polluted inherently by prejudice and white supremacy? And I can't answer that question. But it's certainly worth asking.
So the first thing, that's not what I said. What I flatly stated was that under the context of white supremacy, where people that are classified as white have a greater power dynamic than people that are classified as non-white, okay? And so I would equate that to a warden and or prison correctional officer having sex with an inmate. It is definitely a unequal power dynamic. I would also equate that to a supervisor having sex with someone who's employed under them. There is a extreme power dynamic. So I would reiterate the question, under the context of white supremacy, where people that are classified as non-white that have a greater power dynamic than people that are classified as non-white, as a white woman, do you see anything incorrect about a person that is classified as white having sex with a person that is classified as non-white?
You've stumped me, because the dealing with hypotheticals and categories like this, I don't want to categorically state that no white person should ever have sex with a black person, because that seems unreasonable and inhumane.
All right. Much obliged for your...
Oh, God, can I get a question?
I'm done.
Much obliged, Rob in Wisconsin.
Did you say inhumane? I couldn't hear that part.
Did you say inhumane, Dr. Daly, in your answer? Did you say
I did.
Oh, okay. Yes, she said inhumane. She said inhumane. New Jersey, this is like 10 seconds. This should be something super brief. Caller in New Jersey.
Okay, 10 seconds. Okay, real fast, Professor. You said that Joe Biden was less racist
now. And you also said that you have faith that Kamala Harris would be wouldn't basically run as vice president under a racist. And just and are you aware that Ben Carson is in the Trump administration and you classify him as a racist? So what does being less racist mean, and what gives you so much confidence that a non-white person wouldn't work with a racist?
Oh, that's a good question. I think with Joe Biden, I hope that somebody who's, you know, turning 78 today or tomorrow has learned things over the course of his life, and that he is not the person he was when he was 28 years old and first in the Senate from Delaware, which was a slave state, let's remember. So I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt, which isn't to say that I don't think he's a racist at all. I think we're all racists. But, you know, how that's manifested changes. And I hope that, that Joe Biden is, I guess I would just say, less, you know, that he's questioned some of the assumptions that he held in the 1970s and has found that they didn't hold up. I would like to think that. Yeah, Ben Carson, case in point. As, you know, Kamala Harris, I think, well, I just flat out admire her, but I also think she's probably a good judge of character. And whether she would have hung out with Joe Biden in 1978, I can't say. But I hope that the Joe Biden she knows now is someone who has learned enough to regret some of the, you know, things he's done in his life, like most of us.
Okay, but for the record,
hang on a second. Yeah, we got your Aaron. All right, you can get your thing. When you say we're all racist, did you mean everybody, white people and non-white people?
You think non-white people can't be racist?
But just get my question in. So when you say we're all racist, are you saying white people and non-white people are racist?
Well, I was thinking of white people then, but I would, you know, turn it back on you and say, are you saying that non-white people can't be racist?
Are you not going to answer my question?
I thought I just did.
No, you just answered, you asked another question, and that's not an answer to a question.
No. I answered first and then asked the question. I said, when I said that, I was thinking of white people. You're asking me this question makes me wonder if you think that non-whites can't be racist.
We had agreement there's a system of white supremacy racism. Where individuals who classify themselves as white dominate everyone whom they classify as not white. So since we agree that that is true, how then in that context would a non-white person practice racism and against whom?
Well, I think it's too late in the evening to go back and argue over whether or not white supremacy and racism are exactly the same thing. But I appreciate your answer.
I think when we started this program, I said racism and white supremacy as synonyms. I said that, and you agree that the definition was accurate.
That's,
but either way.
True, but maybe I've learned over the course of the evening.
Dr. Jane Daly, our guest from Chicago, Illinois, we discussed her book just published today, White Fright: The Sexual Panic at the Heart of America's Racist History. It has been a hoot, Dr. Daly. We will keep an eye out for new publications and probably even some more chatting about this here text. Thank you for hanging out on this Tuesday evening.
Thank you, Gus. It was my pleasure. And thanks to everybody for their engagement. It was great.
For sure. We will keep up with your writing. Take care, and evening,
thanks.
Dr. Daly. We'll speak soon.
Thanks. Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye. Context of White Supremacy, Dr. Jane Daly, white woman, our guest for the evening. She did say in that context she was speaking white people being racist. Anywho, white guests only. Said that a few times. I guess I need to keep saying it because I've said that for several months now, and then people will still suggest non-white guests. Frequently, they will suggest non-white guests who are in tragic arrangements. white guests only. I think it is that is a major component of the counter-racist work, not squabbling, bickering with other non-white people, victims of racism who are confused about racism. I have just not really seen where there's much payoff. The work that needs to be done is questioning racist man, racist woman, racist child, seriously interrogating what they say and getting a better analysis of what it means to be white. That is what is lacking with non-white people not sitting around and, yeah, I'm going to curse out and call such and such a coon and a Sambo. When she mentioned the Hemings of Monticello, I have that book, Annette Gordon Reed, black female professor, I think at New York University. And she's written several books about the Hemings and Thomas Jefferson and all of that. The one of the books, The Hemings of Monticello, An American Family. An American Family. Now, we could get Annette Gordon Reed, victim of white supremacy. We could get her on the program and squabble and fight about this. And what do you mean Sally Hemings loved Thomas Jefferson? What are you talking about? They had a deep relationship and blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, this is a thick book. Like, woof. I think Thomason in New York said he thought Warmth of Other Suns was too long and wordy and blah, blah, blah. Woof. This is like you could do some weightlifting with the Hemings of Monticello. We could argue and squabble with Annette Gordon Reed about her text, her views on racism, or we could get to the root of the problem. And I contend white people, the Jane Daly's of the world, they are the ones that are responsible for non-white people being confused about white supremacy racism. When we don't use accurate language and speak truthfully about this problem, this is how you end up classifying this arrangement as a so-called loving family, as opposed to, regardless of whatever Sally Hemings' emotional feelings were about Thomas Jefferson or anybody else, just following logic, this is rape and that's that. And, you know, we could talk about whatever else within that, but just following logic, and that is frequently not there. That's why you have so many non-white people who are confused about racism, white supremacy. That's why when we use terms like race relations, had that one this evening. Lots of confounding terms, and this person is a racial extremist, and non-white people are racist. Maybe Joe Biden is less racist. When we talk about racism and white supremacy in not the most accurate terms, it creates confusion. That's a major component of how this system continues. Metaphors, that's why we have no metaphors on Saturday. That's a big component of it as well. The use of the term fair came up several times this evening. That is one I've emphasized for years. That term should not be used. And that term synonymous with beauty, correctness or logic, and whiteness. You're being reasonable. You're being white. You're being just. You're being white. You're beautiful, being white, all of those things. So I've said that should not be used. And it was at critical moments where she was acknowledging that, yeah, that's true. I probably didn't use the most accurate terms to describe this problem, racism, white supremacy. She said that's a fair critique. Came up several times. Let's see. Anything else? I'll make sure. The laughter, I'm so glad that's something I think we started pointing out with white guests in around 2014. It could easily be a whole program and do kind of a down memory lane because it's so frequent. We have white guests on the program that there will be lots of chuckles and har, 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 as though this is, you know, Steve Harvey hour, you know, Kevin Hart. And we're talking about lynchings and castrations and Pitchfork Ben Tillman. Like, this is not, you know, comedy hour. And they're just har, 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 har. And sometimes it'll even be when someone is questioning, like, are you specifically practicing racism.
You got me. That was a good. Yeah, yep, that's fair. That's fair.
Excellent job being mindful of that. Again, white guests only. It's for that specific reason. Being able to point out white guests to not being honest. And we should be doing that. Point that out. I don't think you're being honest. I don't think you answered my question. And, you know, be able to point that out. I think that's super important. And specifically doing that in a context where other victims of white supremacy can observe that happening, because it is so infrequent. This book just came out today. Like, I knew it just came out this month. I didn't know it came out today. But I'm certain, particularly in this environment, she'll probably be getting interviews and what have you. The people come out and, oh, come talk in this, and blah, 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 and Black Lives Matter and all the rest of it. I suspect most of the non-white people who are talking to her or interviewing her are not going to do so with suspicion. That is, in my view, way more important than squabbling, bickering with other victims of white supremacy who are confused. Of course, I'm still confused. That's, you know, not a surprise to bump into a non-white person who's confused about racism. But arguing and squabbling with other non-white people who are confused about racism, I think we have better ways to invest our time here at the COWS. All of that said, I so want to read this book, though, The Hemings of Monticello. Like, just, you know, part of me, I mean, is like, wow, there have to be better ways to invest my time. Let me see. Let's see. Here, I'll read a little bit. This is The Hemings of Monticello. Jefferson's characterization of enslaved women as this tender part of our species engaged in labor disproportionate to their sex demonstrates that he knew the obvious. Black women did not have the physical strength equal to that of black men. In addition, black women, not black men, were the ones having babies and breastfeeding them, thus interfering with their capacity to work efficiently. Everything he wrote about women suggests that for Jefferson, biology was destiny. Their defined roles vis-a-vis males and children were the reasons that the home was the most suitable place for them. Where did that lead the enslaved women at Monticello who were not members of the Hemings family? The issue, as in so many other areas of Jefferson's views on race, was that certain truths had to be overridden or rationalized when they bumped up against extreme self-interest that did not rest comfortably with the implications of those truths. Jefferson could place black women among the tender part of the human species, along with the peasant women in the fields of Europe and the Native American women in his own country, see them as ill-equipped relative to men for field work, and still send them there because it suited his needs and the needs of his society. Yeah, I will stop there. Yeah. Lots of non-white people confused about racism, white supremacy. Folks who were with us, any thoughts, what they heard from Dr. Day? Let's see, we'll start with non-Clemson grad since we didn't, or he didn't get to ask a question.
No worries. I did hear a good amount of the broadcast this evening, but I was in and out, either taking care of things around the house. But it was very interesting. Aside from the fact that, you know, obviously she agreed to the definition of racism at the beginning of the episode, when Ben Carson came up, all of a sudden Ben Carson was racist. Now, to me, what I was wondering is that at one point in the broadcast, she said that, you know, she completely said that Trump was racist. You know, apparently that's okay to say right now in 2020. But when Biden, when the question is asked of Biden, all of a sudden he used to be racist, or he is, and which is, you know, how does she measure that as him being less racist now? And then of course, the idea that someone could be less or more racist, I wonder how she is coming to those conclusions. So, for example, at least in the context of someone like Ben Carson, you know, is Ben Carson racist just because he works for President Trump? Does that mean any black person or non-white person, for that matter, who works for a white person is, you know, somewhat racist or racist in general? Because I think at some point that means every black person, at least every black person I've ever met, is racist. And I'll leave it at that.
Any non-white person who can truthfully say, oh, yeah, I work for Billy, I work for Susan, Theodore, she, he, definitely not a racist, you know, voted for Obama 3 times. He wrote his name in on the ballot once. Like, absolutely not a racist. He calls President Trump names every day. I mean, every day that I come in, he's got a whole dartboard, and he just throws little darts at President Trump's face every day and calls him a racist. I mean, Billy is not a racist. He gives me my check on time, and, you know. Let's see. Other folks, make sure we didn't miss anybody. Totally. Yeah. Other folks.
Can I follow up?
Caller in New Jersey.
Yeah, because I wanted to follow up because she says that, you know, she trusts Kamala Harris's judgment. And I was going to say Kamala Harris is on record saying that she believes the accuser of Joe Biden, the woman who came forward and said Joe Biden sexually assaulted her years ago. So to say that she, you know, trusts Kamala Harris's judgment, you know, but again, she admitted that the whole system is a total contradiction. So it's not surprising that she would say something that contradicts. And to follow up what the caller just was saying, in context, she was basically saying that she doesn't think Kamala Harris will work for a racist because, you know, ma'am, she's non-white. And that's why I brought up that, okay, we do have a non-black person, Ben Carson, Omarosa, working under Trump. You know, so to say that somebody non-white wouldn't work for a racist and she has good judgment and she's on record of agreeing with the alleged victim of Joe Biden. I mean, it was just, you know, total contradiction and right on for having white, I guess. I'll cheer that on. Continue.
Much obliged. Caller in New Jersey. We've talked to a lot of victims over those 12 years. I said Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, she's a victim of racism. She's in there too, 2010. Other folks, if you have comments, observations to share, Dr. Daly.
Can I be heard?
Mo in Dallas.
Thank you. I was like more confused after listening to her. I didn't want to keep like jumping in and off of mute. I don't know if I could be heard doing that, but I really wanted to know what did she mean when she said it's inhumane to not have sex with black people. Like, I did not understand what she meant by that. Like, she's very confusing when she speaks, and I think she was practicing a lot of racism.
I think I'd have to go back to listen specifically to like get the exact quote, but I think she was saying like she thought it would be inhumane to like tell people not to engage in sexual intercourse between white people and black people. I think that was how she used it in saying that that would be inhumane. Yeah, I didn't hear you wanted additional clarification. I would have seen if we could have got that before she exited.
Yeah, I would like to know, like, how is that inhumane? That was just, you know, but I should have. Sorry.
No worries. No apology needed there. Yeah, I wish we could have got, she could have given us elaboration before departing on that one. White people and the way that they use words is worthy of study, particularly if you find yourself being confused about, you know, what's been said and or not answering your question, where you have to keep going back and, you know, answer the question, that type of thing. Other folks that tuned in.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard? Nope. Female folks.
Thank you. When she said inhumane, what I thought was it was inhumane for white people because, you know, they're humans and they should be able to have sex with whoever they want to have sex with. She acted like a white person. I didn't understand when I asked her my question initially. She said that I answered the question that I asked her. I didn't understand how she got that. And just, you know, just the, I guess, because as I said, she's not stupid. She wrote several books. But she kept on going around the question. Yeah, I'm sorry I missed like the bulk of the program because I really wanted to hear how she agreed with your definition of race and white supremacy because she kind of threw me off and she was like, isn't everybody racist? And I'm like, what? Like, where are we going? Like, how did we get here? But yeah, I need to I'm gonna listen to it when it's done. All right, that's it.
She did agree with the definition and promptly too. This was not one of those where, you know, we had to go around the bin and back again and oh, and him and haw and blah, blah, blah. It, pretty prompt. Yes. Accurate. Blah, blah, blah. All that. That was when I reminded her that we had agreement about the definition. It was like, oh, it's so late and I'm tired and can't think. And yeah. Yeah. Robin was California. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. So I was very surprised when I was asking her my last question and she stated that she was stumped. Right? And so now, just for clarification, what is her profession again?
She's a historian at the University of Chicago. She studies race, sex in the post-emancipation South.
Right, so like laughable at best when she said that she was stumped by this nigra. Right, asking her a question when and this was another thing that stood out to me when the program was in the initial stages, and I think that the program floated back to the 1800s, 1840 or something like that, and she gave the impression. Not even the impression. I want to say that she stated a fact that she didn't know what the literacy level of black people were in that era. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but black people were killed, limbs amputated, and the like. If we were caught with a book and or trying to read a word. So as her being a historian, I thought that she was on this program this evening. I thought that she was very disingenuous. And my acute observation is that she didn't think that she was going to encounter quote unquote smart, intelligent black people. And it really kind of had her off balance. Right. And, the last part, like the question that I didn't get to ask her, and I was surprised that no one asked her on the program, have she ever had sex with a non-white person? And maybe I missed it if someone asked the question, but that's where I was you know, that's where I was going to. And thank you for listening.
Much obliged, Rob in Wisconsin. I always have that on my list, that question to ask when we have a white guest on the program. I don't always ask it because I think it's great. Listeners sometimes ask. I know Thomas in New York asks frequently, and we've had a number of other guests who ask. So love giving other folks an opportunity to ask that question. And also, Gus T is hated by a number of victims of racism and, of course, racists, but that's, you know, what it's supposed to be. That becomes one of the reasons they say, oh, my God, that coon Gus has this fixation with sexual intercourse, asking white people who they've had sex with, and even victims of racism if they've been married to a white person and all this nonsense and all in everyone's head. So just for me personally, over 12 years, you do get tired being tarred with, why is he always focusing on sex? Doesn't you can't even ask other questions. I do not stop that from asking. I just don't always like to ask. So it was not asked today. Oh, well. Other folks, comments that they would like to get in.
I guess like her to add like more to her profile. I think she went to Yale and Princeton, I think. And then, yeah, it was interesting. Like she agreed with your definition, and all of a sudden, like black males during slavery have, I guess, what they call agency. So I'm like, what's going on? Like, like it was just, I don't think she had, I got to think about it, but I'm not sure if she was as prepared as some of, like, your other white callers, I mean, white guests that have been on. Because she definitely would go, like, back and forth and sometimes be, I guess, like, she was quiet for a while at the question that the gentleman asked about so-called interracial sex or whatever. And I don't think she answered the gentleman's question because she said, like, that she didn't think that, you know, that it would be inhumane if people, like, if, like, non-white and white people never had sex. But, like, the gentleman asked, like two or three times, like, he was talking about, like, you know, under a system of racism, white supremacy. So, yeah, there were multiple questions that she didn't really answer. But I'm not sure if she did it as, in as clever a way as, like, other white guests. Thank you.
Interesting observation. Not as well prepared. Let's see. Other folks. Other folks that we missed, who had a hand up. Let's see.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Typical white female. Think that was very slick and very how she she alluded to black people being able to practice racism. And you know, she says, well, we could talk about that later. You just spoke about it. I thought that was intentional and very slick, you know. I think a great follower would have been, well, give us an example of how these black people practice racism. But I think she was practicing racism. The looting in Chicago, I got a lot of pictures of these white people doing it. I don't know. I do know that the mainstream media only focused on the few black people I seen looting and did not show a lot of the white people. You only could see that on people's, like, live feeds. So, very squazzily done by the mainstream media, as I suspected. And I'm with my wife. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I think they had so many different rounds of rioting. Chicago is one of those places where it wasn't like a one-time or two-time thing. It was happening like repeatedly, where they were out running around in the streets. So, yeah, I would be in Chicago, has so many people, I'd be surprised if they didn't have, you know, a good number of white people out doing some, you know, ruckus as well. Let's see. Were there other folks that had a hand up, commentary to share?
Hi, guys.
We invoke. I'm quiet. I'm sorry.
Me in Toronto. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. It would have been interesting to find out if Jane would actually go back and make that correction or add that information about Mildred being 11. I still found it really interesting that it didn't seem as if she was taking the concept of the pedophilia plus the racial terrorism seriously, considering her laughter, even though she did clarify it, I'm sure to save face. It was just really interesting, and I would have wanted to find out if she was going to go back and input that information, or if she's going to leave it omitted out of her book regarding Mildred's age. Thank you.
Much obliged, be in Toronto. I hope they're done shooting for a while in your area. That is for sure not going in the second edition, third edition, Kindle edition, nothing else. Like, no way. I thought that was important. Like I said, I'd highlighted that in the text because, I mean, that just seems right. Not just for her, but the editor. That's the sort of thing that should immediately jump out. If you were listing your children, I don't have children, but if you had offspring, if you have more than one, if you were listing your children and going down the line and, you know, this is Asada and she's 15 and, you know, this is Malcolm. Well, how old is Malcolm? Is he 5'2"? Like, what in the world? Like, if you're going to start giving out ages, why don't you give everybody's age to... He's 17, and Mildred is young. That sort of thing by someone who is a historian. It is your job to be precise with that sort of thing, dates. And then, like I said, it's immediate. It's the very next, like, couple sentences where she says, 17, sorry, and Mildred is young. And you come right under that, and now by the time they get to the Supreme Court, he's 24 and Mildred is 18. Now we can give everybody's ages when it's a little bit more acceptable. Same thing I said before. If you rewind that like a couple of days, not years, just days, where he's 24 and she's 17, you make it 24 and 17. That is statutory rape, and this is not a disguise. I suspect probably at that time that would have been statutory rape, like 17. And 24, this is not a Supreme Court case. Get the handcuffs, and we having a whole different discussion about all this nonsense. Very important point. Same thing with the Loving case. With the Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. That we also talked about 35-ish, 37, 14. Make it plain. Were there other folks who had commentary?
I was just going to say she invoked her grandchildren and withdrew them very swiftly when she saw that they weren't that wasn't going to like sway any opinions on the system. I just thought that was interesting.
Called it the grandchildren card. I hadn't even heard that one before. I'm like, what? What are we talking about?
Me neither. That's what got me. I was like, card?
Which, again, all of that is in the rubric. When Dr. Welsing has talked about before, when they say the race card, that one I have. Jeff Toobin, run of his life. We are 1 week away. I'm so excited. But when they bring out that metaphor, that rhetoric, the race card and the grandchildren card, whatever new ones they add, this is not a game. We are not sitting down for, you know, spades or blackjack or what have you, little parlor game of cards. That's not what the system of white supremacy is. This is terrorism. People die around this. So even that languaging and how, just again, how we're using words, the grandchildren card. And then, as he stated, immediately retracted just when attention was called to, what does that mean? Oh, my bad, my bad. Let me get my grandchild. Got a bunch of these cards here. I'll find another one.
Oh, did she ever specify if this grandchild was a daughter or son?
I thought she said grandchild, but then I think when Rob was giving his response, he said granddaughter. So maybe I misheard. Did she state explicitly that she has two granddaughters, or did she just say she had grandchildren?
No. I mean, was this her daughter or son's child?
She said daughter-in-law.
Yeah,
so
daughter-in-law.
So it's non-white.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, I never got clarification because when I stated, if I asked her if she was defending white people in her family, she never stated if she had male or female children.
I see.
Yeah, and it is confusing because they could be in the A community and adopt. So that is right. So even if she does have a daughter-in-law, that doesn't mean she doesn't have a daughter that didn't get married to a woman.
True. Very true. Very true. Lots of ways for the non-white children to be there. Well, other folks, did we miss anyone? Anybody else have comments that they wanted to share? Oh, Lord. We did our 3 hours.
I just want to say something real quick. I still didn't understand this idea of the fear of black sexuality. Because, I mean, like, if you're raping people, like, what is the fear? What is the fear if you're raping people? And having, as I'm saying, like, what's what I'm looking for? I don't even want to say unwanted sex because that sounds too nice. But if you're terrorizing people and raping people, like, what is the fear? You know, I don't know if my question made sense or if it sounded too abstract or what, but I didn't understand what you were saying about the fear. And I wanted to comment on that snippet of, I think, the book that you read. Yeah, because I don't think you should read that book. It doesn't sound constructive. But what stood out to me that was interesting was the term when tender, and it made me think of the delectable Negro, made me think about tenderizing meat and stuff like that. And that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Oh, great point. Great point. Delectable Negro. That is top 10, like Vincent Woodard. I'm so glad we got to read that in the book club not too long ago. If you didn't get to read it with us, like, wow, you should go back, check it out, read it, or reread it. It has just fantastic information and tender. In fact, it's quite a few delectable Negro. But that is from Annette Gordon Reed's book that I was reading from. She's a victim of racism, you know. Yeah. But from Dr. Daly's book that we read this evening, she writes, faced with the Brown decision, the different elements among the white citizenry had reacted in a variety of ways. The more respectable segregationists. Now, that's what I mean. What if respectable segregationists? Like, what? Anyway, in town, joined the White Citizens Council, which announced that it intended to maintain complete segregation of the races and make it difficult, if not impossible, for any Negro who advocates a desegregation to find and hold a job, get credit, or renew a mortgage. Less savory whites turned to their own form of direct action. In September 1964, arsonists burned down two Dallas County black schools to the ground. You should maybe get that footnote from Owen Dallas, see if you can get some more information about that, or see if some of your relatives, if they live in the area, remember that. But Yeah, but at
what year?
1964, September 1964, Dallas County burned down two black schools. It's footnoted, so she might have information.
I'll ask my aunt. She was alive.
Okay. See, we can be doing little stuff like that. I encourage that, like just talking, because that's a major event. Like if you are alive and some racists burned down a black school, like, oh, yeah, I would remember that. Like, absolutely. Like maybe even have some newspaper clippings and such online. But this was done by the less savory whites. You talk about like gravy is savory, right? Mashed potatoes, savory. Cornbread is savory. Soups are savory. And then you got less savory whites who burned down the black school. That's the caller who talked about the literacy rates. That's what I was thinking. Like, I'm not a history scholar, but I know in Virginia, which is where she was talking about the genesis of her research, they closed public schools for 5 years in Prince Edward County, and that had a hugely adverse impact on black students there. They opened up private schools for white children and all of that. Like, that is no guesswork. That did have a direct impact on the literacy rates of black children, and that sort of thing was happening widespread. White people finding ways of hampering the academic progress of black. Pitchfork Ben Tillman, who is mentioned in the text. Anywho, let me get the footnote since we're here. Let's see if I can do it quick enough. We'll be here Thursday, last session on CASED. I am overjoyed. Stevie Wonder, we will wrap things up. She uses the word CASED in this year book one time. I was like, oh man, Isabel, if this book had been published earlier, maybe Isabel Wilkerson would have had this in the text too. Let's see. The Dallas. Be in Toronto while I'm scrounging for the footnote.
Yes, I just wanted to make point of clarification. It was another caller that had made reference to Sally Hemings' age and Thomas Jefferson's age, which was also a great point added, being that she was 14 and he being in his 30s, again, a very unusual situation. But with Dr. Jane Daly being a historian, I'm also surprised that she's never included instances in history such as the Civil War, where General Benjamin Butler in 1862 sanctioned the use of sexual violence to subdue and punish Confederate women in New Orleans who, quote-unquote, insulted or offended federal troops. So, in other words, Union officers from the North used rape and the threat of sexual violence as weapons of warfare against Southern women, black and white, but in particular against, if it was an elite, quote-unquote, elite white woman, then it would be against her black servants, regardless of the age. So it's just really interesting that she's not made the appropriate comparisons, and again, heralding pedophilia as some sort of interracial relationship. Thanks, and I'll leave the line.
Much obliged, be in Dallas. I think this is, I have to double check to be sure, but I think the school burning is in Dallas County, Alabama, not Dallas County in Texas. But I'll double check the footnote that I was referencing. It's citing locations in Alabama where they were doing all this terrorist activity. Not that they didn't have all this in Texas too, but just to clarify and make sure we're talking about the correct location with the schools. But I'll double check because it does have some different sources to make sure we're talking about the correct region. Anywho, here on Thursday, the book club CASED Isabel Wilkerson. Much obliged to B's points as well about the pedophilia component. I think that's so critical because so many times when we talk about racism, white supremacy, whether it's slavery or many of the other eras, it is not discussed as child rape. It's discussed as whatever else. They can call it sexual trauma or loving relationships or whatever. Child rape. That's what a lot of this is. And I think That makes it more direct. I'm so glad. I wasn't even going to read that, the section, because I can't read everything you highlight in the text either. But just the portion about the ages, where she didn't include that. Now, she said it wasn't conscious. I don't know. Even with the editor, because that's one where I would say the editor should have looked at that and said, hey, why not get Mildred's age here, too? You got him at 17. How old was she? Like, come on, let's be balanced. Direct. I don't think, and books are edited. Like, this book probably was not something she'd been, I should have asked that to see how long she had been working on it, but I mean, man, you edit a book, you read it and reread it and reread it and go over, and you have somebody else that go over and check and check and check and check. I don't know if that was a whoops, just didn't think about the age. It's pretty deliberate where white people don't want us to think about this as child rape, even getting to that power dynamic and the incorrectness of all this. It really makes that power dynamic glaring. 17 and 11, 37 and 14. Put it in your face, like, ugh, making me think of Harvey Weinstein, and you should. Jeffrey Epstein, and you should. Jimmy Savile, and you should. Jerry Sandusky, need one more. Thursday, wrapping up case, Isabel Wilkerson. You should go back, in fact, and listen to Nell Irvin Painter. That's a cowbell. There was no cowbell today because it had just been the whole program, but Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, The History of White People, talked about that, the history, the aspect of white culture and their obsession, sexual obsession with children long term. We talked about that. She married a white man too, but we talked about that. The History of White People. That book is not in my top 10. We'll be here Thursday for CASED, Friday for Neutralizing Workplace Racism, and Saturday, Compensatory Call-In. Much obliged for the folks who participated. Hope it was worthy of your Tuesday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We will need our brain computer to foil the likes of Jane Daly and such. In addition to being sober, I would say hunker down. Be in Toronto said they were shooting in Toronto on this past weekend. It's been flagrant terrorism throughout the U.S., looting in Chicago. They've been ransacking Portland for months now. Lots of reasons to hunker down. They got, in fact, they got increasing Rona restrictions in a lot of places. They said, I was reading in California, they said they were doing another round of shutdowns and curfews and all the rest. Hunker down. If you got to go out, it's something serious. You are very alert to what is happening in your area. If it looks like somebody is being loud, rowdy, we're not escalating, no verbal confrontations, especially with white people or non-white people. We should be thinking, this female, this male could be armed. This white person might have a whole gang of other white people who are with them in the car or in the store or wherever, and they also could be armed. This might be a plainclothes enforcement officer. Lots of hazards, no need for unnecessary risks this year. If it looks like things are becoming loud and unsafe, we are all out of here. We'll try this again. No need to put ourselves in vulnerable positions. If we got to go out, so it's we are sober, buckled, super alert. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. Again, just doing the small things to keep ourselves safe under very dangerous conditions. Number one, we need to be very aware of our environment. And as I said, we're trying to minimize contact with the Amber Geigers of the known universe. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect anytime we are in contact with another black person. No name calling. No name calling. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.